Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing the latest therapies and cancer specialists who are experienced in your cancer. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Today on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Donald Trump said that George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq was the single worst decision ever made. During the 2016 election, he called Jeb Bush weak, stiff, and an embarrassment to his family. But President George H.W. Bush put the family rivalries aside by inviting Trump to his funeral. Open Lines asked, in these partisan times, is the former president showing us a better way? Then legendary chef Jacques Pepin joins us to discuss the influence he's had on the world of culinary arts and how for 30 years, the program he started with Julia Child at BU has been teaching future chefs.
Ramen noodles, 10 hours on skis, one pair of underwear, and a 300-pound Norwegian sled. This is just some of what it takes to defy death in a race beyond the South Pole. We talked to sports reporter Trenny Kuznarek about this and more coming up on Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We're broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello, Jim.
Big food day today. Dory Greenspan ends the show with a great new cookbook, Corby Comer in the middle, and then Jacques Pepin in about 30 minutes. How fabulous is he, by the way?
Well, you've got a whole bunch of new recipes to try out.
He is really terrific.
Our little Martha Stewart.
But before we get to food, during the 2016 GOP primary candidate, primary candidate Trump, as you well recall, fixated on Jeb Bush.
What are you doing, Jeb? What are you doing? But, you know, this poor, pathetic, low-energy guy, he gets up and he does a commercial that Hillary, they show Hillary winning an election. It's great.
And that's just I defined him. I gave him this term, low energy. I said he's a low energy individual. We do not need in this country.
Jeb is a weak and ineffective person. He's also a low energy person, which I've said before, but he's a weak and ineffective person. Jeb is an embarrassment to himself and to his family.
An embarrassment to his family. So Jeb wasn't the only Bush that Trump criticized. He said that George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq was maybe the worst decision ever made by the U.S. And then this July, I'm not done yet, he mocked President George H.W. Bush for using the phrase 1,000 points of light to describe America's promise and its progress.
You know, all the rhetoric you see here, the 1,000 points of light. What the hell was that, by the way? 1,000 points of light. What did that mean? Does anyone know? I know one thing. Make America great again, we understand. Yeah. Putting America first, we understand. 1,000 points of light. I never quite got that one. What the hell is that? Has anyone ever figured that one out? And it was put out by a Republican, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, actually. President George H.W. Bush decided to put these family rivalries aside by inviting President Trump to his funeral tomorrow. It's certainly an example of grace, but is it one you could follow? Our number is 877-301-8970. Would you have it in you to transcend this kind of enmity? Is this a testament to Bush's leadership? Or like John McCain, would you make Trump a president non-grad? I can answer this question right away. I would not have in me what George H.W. Bush had. What we are hearing is he decided, as contemptuous as he may have been personally, he didn't even vote for Trump. He voted for Hillary Clinton. As contemptuous as he may have been of Donald Trump the person, he had great respect for the institution. So he decided that the right thing was to invite the President of the United States, who will not be speaking, even though the protocol generally is the head of state speaks at the funeral of the of a prior head of state, but that won't happen tomorrow. Why are you smiling?
I've been distracted because while you've been talking, the former President Bush's service dog, Sully, is up next to the casket, the rotunda, and now he's lying down next to.
We saw that beautiful photograph you mentioned yesterday.
You know, incredible. You wonder whether, because the dogs have such a strong sense of smell, he could tell that his master's in the coffin,
maybe.
Or I don't know.
You know, I know you want to talk about the dog. I actually want to talk about what we're here for, but why should that stop you? You know, not only would I not have it in me,
dog.
But you know, there's a piece of me that says that George Bush was not purely doing this out of graciousness, mm-hmm. but he was doing it in part out of deviousness. Because I'll tell you, I cannot imagine how incredible the moment's going to be. Do you remember a week ago what Donald Trump retweeted? He retweets a graphic of prison bars. And behind the prison bars are Barack Obama, who will be there tomorrow.
Yep.
Hillary Clinton, I assume, will be there tomorrow.
With her
Bill
husband.
Clinton
yep, Bill
will
Clinton.
Be there tomorrow. And all these other people.
About a dozen people.
So Donald Trump has to hang out with his predecessors and others who he had behind bars on his Twitter account a few days ago. So, you know, in many ways, I was talking to Chelsea, our leader, before the show started, and she said something that was really interesting. By inviting him, you basically take power away from Trump. To be Trump, to be, if he wasn't invited, if he was excluded, like he was from Barbara Bush's funeral or from John McCain's funeral, you know, he'd be tweeting, what a piece of you-know-what, George H.W. Bush. That's who Trump really is. But he takes that away from him, and Trump almost has to act like a head of state. Did you watch the thing last night on CNN?
I did.
When
he
and Melania walked in to give their minute and 15 tribute to him?
It was very odd.
Well, it was, but what are they supposed to, I mean,
well,
they,
because usually you when you walk in, you pay respects to President Bush, and then you greet some family members.
Oh, that's a good point.
People.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it was kind of this odd thing where they walked in and stood there, I don't know, for a minute or two. He saluted.
One
she put her hand over
seconds,
her heart, and they
yeah.
walked out. So, I mean, there was nothing wrong with it.
Nothing wrong
it was
with
just,
it.
It was just, you know, you saw pictures of Nancy Pelosi hugging a W. Bush, and usually there's some interaction there you didn't see. But this is a
But in all fairness, I mean, you have to admire President Trump for being consistent, because if you really want all of these people behind bars, it's very difficult to at the same time. You know, tomorrow, I have to say, I'm interested in what John Meacham has to say, the former Prime Minister of Canada. Actually, I'm very interested in what George W. has to say
absolutely.
About his father. Because clearly it was a love affair between father and son.
Well, you saw him fighting back tears almost all day long yesterday.
But having said that, the thing that I am most interested in, and we'll get to describe it live on the radio tomorrow, is Donald Trump's interaction with people he has wanted jailed, people who he has led chance of lock her up at rallies. I mean, is this going to be one of the most awkward things ever?
He's going to be in the front row, I guess, because he the president.
Well,
too bad they couldn't put him in the 10th row.
No,
that would make me happy.
He is the president.
But he's
going
to be in the front row. He's not going to get to speak.
Nope.
So, of course, a lot of them, rest of them aren't speaking either.
Yeah, but he's the president. They're not currently the president.
Yeah, that is the tradition.
So, Marjorie,
but he can kind of get around that tradition by saying another former president, his son, is the guy that's doing the eulogy.
Okay, so, Marjorie, let's get to this
question.
Could
I do it myself?
Yes. And
absolutely not.
Well, I don't agree. You're a far better person than
Are
I am.
Kidding?
I think we all know that.
Someone that had insulted my children, ridiculed my children over
okay,
and
over
again.
Okay, let's test it out here. One of your son, by the way, Marjorie, as you know, I've many times said is low energy. your youngest daughter, I have said, maybe made the worst decision ever in the history of the United States. And what I said about you is, you know that column you wrote for The Globe? What the hell was that?
Yeah, you're weak and you're embarrassing and you're a terrible person. No, I mean, I get why H.W. did it, because he's honoring the office of the president of the United States. And Chelsea's got a great point, taking the power away from Trump. But I certainly couldn't do it. I know
you could never
do it in a million years.
Never.
But I guess the thing is this legitimizing Trump in a way that's upsetting to people who really don't like him, or does it just make him look like the outlier in a sea of people who had their faults and made a lot of mistakes?
Can I tell you something?
Weren't quite at this level.
I could never do it, but I think George H.W. Bush did the right thing. I mean, he is inviting the man who fills the office. No one thinks he has respect for the man who is in the office. Because of the fact, one, he didn't vote for him. Two, he loves his kids. And obviously he knows how his wife Barbara felt.
But of course, McCain did not invite him.
Correct.
So is McCain wrong?
First of all, McCain is a different. McCain was not president of the United States.
Right.
I think that makes a difference. I don't know. I don't know. I would argue that qualitatively what he said about John McCain is and his disrespect for veterans is far worse than calling Jeb
Cage in North Vietnam.
Well, it's not just that. It's Keyser Khan and his son and his wife. And I would argue that's even worse if you can rate these things and calling Jeb low energy and trashing, you know, 1,000 points of light. That's just classless kind of behavior. the way he treated and speaks about veterans and his performance on Veterans Day and in France is just unconscionable. In any case, now it's your turn. 877-301-8970. Did George H.W. Bush, in your estimation, do the right thing by inviting the current occupant of the Oval Office? That would be the 45th President of the United States. And two, be honest, Marjorie and I have admitted without any shadow of a doubt we would not have it in us to do the same thing in similar circumstances. Would you? And if you would, why? Let's go to Mike in Boston. You're first on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Hi there, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi. What's
can
up? Yes, we can. Shoot.
Great. I agreed with your point that with great grace, President Bush invited the office of the president and not necessarily Donald Trump. And if it was up to me, I'd send him a formal invitation that said, you're not invited.
That's what you do. Yeah, well, I think we're probably as low rent as you are, Mike. I think Marjorie and I are in the same boat. Thank you for the call. 877-301-8970.
Paul in Worcester. Thanks for calling, Paul.
Hello, Paul.
Hey, Marjorie and Jim. How are you?
Good.
Fine, thank you.
I agree completely with everything Jim has said. Trump can't dodge this. He has to sit down and shut up for what could go longer than a Trump rally while listening to others speak highly of someone other than Trump. And with a sincerity that Trump will probably not receive when he passes. It's not all about Trump. It isn't at all about Trump.
And you know, Paul, you said you agreed with me. You actually said it 10 times better than I did. That is a perfect analysis of what tomorrow is going to be like. But keep going.
And well, if I thought it through, I would absolutely invite him specifically just so I could get the last laugh in a sense. Just watch him shut up.
Well, you know, and we will see that scene whatever time this starts tomorrow. Even though Trump seems to be immune to normal human emotions, you got to think he's saying, I got to go shake the hand and hopefully they will shake my hand of people who I've been trashing regularly, arguing should be imprisoned and such things. Paul, thanks for a great call.
Imagine 10, 20 years down the road, whenever it is that Trump dies, his funeral, he'll be lying in state. Mm-hmm. The Capitol building. That's going to be tough for a lot of people to take, I think.
Maybe tough. But you know what's another interesting thing? Michelle Obama, who's basically kept her thoughts to herself about Donald Trump until the book.
Right.
And says how angry his birtherism comments made her because she thought it put her whole family, including her kids, at risk. Now, while she's a pretty gracious person, to say the least, how does she greet? I assume she greets Melania warmly and does not greet the current president warmly, and what happens? How does this all work tomorrow?
I don't know. You know, I thought a lot about that when people, just in your own personal life, have done something really upsetting to you or to your family or something. Mm-hmm. When you see them in some kind of public way or somebody else's funeral, what are you supposed to do? You know, I've never really had that confrontation, but I thought about it sometimes with people that have not been very nice.
Do you ever
nice.
Have a, you know what, I had a moment the other day at this memorial for this great political consultant.
Well, you probably have a lot of them,
John Martilla, where a politician who shall not be named is walking down the aisle, who can't stand me, by the way. I mean, really can't stand
really?
Me.
But I can't imagine.
We won't say who he is. Mm-hmm. And because we hadn't seen each other in a while, he forgot. And when our eyes met, he goes, hey, Jim, and then as soon as he says, hey, Jim, he realizes how much contempt he has for me. And so it's one of these things where you got to change your mood,
your
emotion.
Yeah, did he pull his hand away?
No, he didn't attempt to shake my hand. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the decision by George H.W. Bush, who, as I'm sure you know, planned his funeral almost to every single detail. The decision he made to invite the current president, who has insulted every member of President H.W. Bush's family, including he himself, and whether you agree with that decision, whether you could make a comparable decision in your own personal life in similar sort of circumstances. Marjorie and I have both acknowledged that neither of us could have done it for a second.
Of course, I don't think I would be able to be presidential.
No. How about in your circle of friends? Somebody who, you don't have to obviously name it, somebody who's been unkind to one of your kids who lives next door. They wouldn't be invited.
Well, they wouldn't probably show up. That's what's so weird about this. I mean, you don't have people that you, for the most part, except for members in your family, I suppose, mm-hmm. that you have really bad blood with. They're not going to show up at your funeral. But the this is different because it's the President of the United States.
If they might, I would probably ask that they not be there. But obviously, George H.W. Bush is a bigger man in that way than you and I are.
Bill from Framingham, what do you think, Bill?
Hey, Bill.
Hello. I actually think the president is very used to being the most disliked person in the room. And so this will just be another one of those rooms where nobody really likes him. I think it's very normal for him.
Well, I don't agree with you. I mean, look at the rallies. He never appears in a setting where there are any dissenting opinions. The rallies are love fests. I think he likes to be – I mean, look at that first cabinet meeting. We ran around the room and said to his cabinet members, okay, each of you go ahead and tell me how much you love me and how great a job I'm doing. I think he likes to be surrounded by sycophants. And I think this is – you may be right, but I think he's going to be in a very uncomfortable situation tomorrow. But we shall see. We'll know by midday. Bill, thanks for the call.
Couple of the emails. Arturo says, H.W. Bush showed us how an adult politician is supposed to act. People
probably
in politics
true.
Are too petty. Art says, I would posit that if you were so small and petty as to carry a grudge that large to your funeral, you're no better than the other guy. Allison says, the current occupant of the White House has shown no respect for the office of the president, to say nothing of his disdain for the Bush family. I feel that 41 missed a real opportunity to make a statement. The message of a handshake from beyond will be totally lost on both the current occupant and the rest of the Republican Party. So there you go.
877-301-8970. Pat in Falmouth, you're on Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. I have to agree with both of you. I wouldn't be able to do it myself. George H.W. Bush was not one of my favorite people at the time, but I have come to admire him more now. I think the outpouring of love for him is at least in part because he illustrates what a change and how far down we have fallen in our leadership. But I do like the idea that maybe George H.W. Bush did have a little deviousness in this
decision. So. I hope so.
John McCain did not have that, protocol problem. And H.W. definitely understood his role as the president, so I kind of like to think that he knew exactly what he was doing.
Maybe so. And, Pat, I want to seize on one thing you said. I don't want this to come out the wrong way, disrespectful of the late President Bush, but I think the way he is – I mean, this to me is fairly obvious. I want to say it carefully, though. The positive way in which he's been viewed the last 3 days is elevated or accentuated by how – by the contrast between him and the current occupant of the office. That's pretty obvious. Is it not in many ways?
Pat, I mean, we all know he did, he did some the Willie Horton thing. Was a terrible thing. He was on the wrong side of the Civil Rights Act of 64. He flip-flopped dramatically to be Reagan's running mate. He went
very
from
slow
being
on AIDS.
Very slow on AIDS, and the gay community is upset about that. He was very much more the classic Republican in terms of social liberal and fiscal conservative before he hooked up with Ronald Reagan when the voodoo economics line went out the window when he became pro-life because the evangelical movement was getting stronger there, and he took a lot of positions that he didn't really believe in. But you know something? You know, anybody, especially because I grew up a little bit after the Vietnam era, but still knew a lot of people that, and Vietnam was a different war than World War II, but anybody who comes from that kind of privilege, who had all the money in the world, could have done whatever they wanted to, who signs up at 18 years old and goes and fights the youngest combat pilot and was haunted almost constantly by the fact that he survived
and
the other guys in
not,
the plane,
no.
Their parachutes didn't open. So, you know, anybody that does that, I mean, more than I've done.
Well, I'll tell you, I think one man who could really appreciate that is a man who had 5 deferments for
Absolutely.
Bone spurs. I think that's a man. 877-301-8970. Tomorrow's obviously the funeral of President George H.W. Bush. He has decided, which is a grand gesture as far as I'm concerned, to invite the current occupant of the office who has disparaged every... Well, I don't know if he disparaged Barbara Bush. Did he ever say anything unkind about Barbara Bush? I don't know.
Not that
did.
I know of.
But all the children...
He was not invited to her funeral.
And I think that was on her wish, was it not? I mean, she was a pretty protective mother of her kids. And I think she didn't like the way he spoke about Jeb. And by the way, we don't know how W voted. He will not say. He said he didn't vote for either of the major candidates. We do know that his father, the late President Bush, voted for Hillary Clinton because of how he felt about soon-to-be President Trump. Our number is 877-301-8970.
Okay, we are taking a break. Are we moving on now?
No.
We're moving on. Okay.
We are not.
We are moving on.
No, we are not.
Oh, we're not. Okay.
No, we're not.
We're talking about George Bush for a little bit longer then. Asking about inviting Trump to his funeral. Did Bush get the last laugh by killing Trump with kindness? That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Donald Trump's rivalry with the Bush family and how George H.W. Bush posthumously is playing peacemaker, I guess you'd say, by inviting Trump to his funeral, taking your calls, asking, is this a lesson for all of us? Could you exhibit this kind of behavior? It's so alien to who I am. It is ridiculous. I couldn't even imagine doing this. But he was a patriot. Yeah. Flaws and all, he was clearly a patriot and decided honoring the institution. I guess it would be a dishonor to the institution of the presidency if he didn't invite the current
So just to be clear, you're keeping a list now so that when the time comes for you to depart this mortal coil, Jim, the list will be intact so everyone will
well,
know.
Well, actually,
to invite.
I haven't done all that planning, but what I've learned, it'll be far cheaper to rent the hall because based on that criterion, there'll be like four people there.
Okay.
Which is perfectly fine. 877-301-8970.
Tom says he hopes George H. Bush bounces up from the dead and slaps Trump silly. That's what he wants to happen tomorrow.
Let's go to Shrewsbury, where Jenna is on the phone. Jenna, you are next on Boston Public Radio from the Boston Public Library.
Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Jenna. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great.
Great.
I've never called before. This is
Ooh.
I wanted to respond to your question about what Michelle Obama will do when she meets Trump after writing about him in her book.
What do you think?
And all I have to say is she'll go high.
Well, that's her
line. When they go low, we go high. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I'm sure she'll give him a nice handshake. We'll see if she kisses him. Probably not.
I would say there's no chance that she is hugging and kissing him. But, you know, by the way, I don't think she went low in the book, but she went honest in the book. And I'm sure you heard a minute ago, I mean, the thing that is being quoted, I haven't read it, but the thing that is being quoted the most is her anger over the birtherism, because she, not just the charge, as spurious as it was, but also because she thought it put her family in danger. And I think she's a person of principle. So I'm guessing she will go high, as you say, and shake his hand and be polite. But I think that's the extent of it. And we'll see how President Obama, who usually takes the high road too, how he reacts after being pictured behind prison bars in one of the tweets from the... You know, by the way, thank you for the call, Jenna. And thank you for your first call. Do it again soon. I know I've said this already. If you haven't seen this yet, just go to, you know, twitter.com/realDonaldTrump and scroll. I think it's about 5 or 6 or 7 days ago. He retweeted an image. I don't know who it came from. They're drawings. They're not photographs. I don't think they're photographs.
I don't remember.
Of maybe 20 famous
people,
all of whom have rubbed Donald Trump the wrong way. Most notably, the two Clintons, Barack Obama. I think the former Attorney General Eric Holder is in there. John Brennan, former head of the CIA. I'm sure Bob Mueller is in there. And essentially, they're all behind bars. It's a very respectful thing from the current president of the United States. And virtually all those people are going to be at the funeral tomorrow.
Can you imagine if in your life someone had done that, like a political opponent?
Oh,
or,
I'd get over it in 2 seconds.
They tweeted out Jim Browdy behind bars
Wouldn't
and his whole family.
Me.
I think it would be very difficult for most of us to get over that. Jim in the car, what do you think, Jim?
Hello, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Long-time listener and... I agree with you guys that I would not have the heart to do what Bush has done. Somebody burnt me and my family. I'm very thick-skinned, didn't bother me. But I ended that person's career for going after my family.
Oh,
but
anyway, wow.
Well, wait, don't move on. What did you do exactly? Without naming names, what did you do there, please?
Well, the person did something to my family that I just couldn't stand. And he was betting on a promotion that would have made the rest of his career.
Yeah.
And I terminated that chance of a promotion.
Well, let me tell you, you're my kind of guy. And maybe we're both going to hell, but we're going to happily go to hell. So I'm with you on this. I'm with you on this. Thank you very much for your call. I mean, that's not, you know, people may be critical of that.
Uh-huh.
Don't you think most of us, it's not just you and me and the caller, that is how most of us would behave. I don't think most of us could go high.
You know what's
in
unbelievable?
Situation.
I mean, remember Ted Cruz? Donald Trump posted a picture of Cruz's wife and Melania and said basically that Cruz's wife was a homely woman, which she is not.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said his father was involved in the JFK assassination with Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean,
then he invited him to Texas.
They
to campaign
reelected
for
him in Texas, but it was almost, to me, so humiliating that Ted Cruz, after that, and his wife, I mean, what did she think when her husband just says, hey, what the hell? He's going to help me get reelected, so what the hell? You know, just be nice to him after he... I mean, I don't get... I thought that alone would disqualify Cruz. Shows how much
well,
I know.
But I don't think Ted Cruz did that because he was being gracious or
generous,
unlike President Bush. He was did it for self-serving reasons.
Exactly,
right.
But I guess you say if you don't care what somebody says about your wife, you don't care what somebody says about your father, what kind of a person are you? I guess we know that because everybody says people hated Ted Cruz even when he was at Harvard Law School, so I guess he was the most...
Who told us that? Jennifer Braceras?
Braceras and Juliette Kayyem. They both said couldn't stand him way back then.
You know, by the way, before an interesting question. We only have a couple more minutes on this. I think it'd be useful to broach that topic. If a particular, let's say, president said your father killed JFK and that your spouse was ugly, how warmly would you greet him?
Exactly. And they hugged each other. Beth in New Hampshire, what do you think, Beth?
Hi.
Hi. Well, I wanted to say two things. First of all, you were wrong. Trump did say something nasty about Barbara.
What did he say?
Really? Well, Barbara, remember, came out and campaigned a little bit for Jeb.
Sure, right at the end of his candidacy, yeah.
Exactly. And then Trump, I mean, not so much nasty about Barbara, but he came out and called out Jeb, saying, you know, now basically calling Jeb a mama's boy for having to have his mom.
That is exactly right. Yeah. You are exactly right. I had totally forgotten that. I'm really glad you reminded us. That's right. I'm sure that made her really, really happy. Thank you for that, Beth. By the way, one of our coworkers brings this up to date. I mentioned this last night in a new book by historian Mark Updegrove. It's called The Last Republicans. President George H.W. Bush called Donald Trump a blowhard. And former President George W. Bush, who will speak tomorrow at the funeral, said this guy doesn't know what it means to be president. I mean, you know, that's one of the most interesting handshakes. I think it's pretty clear that both W. and Jeb, their relationship with their father was incredibly intense and close and loving and that sort of thing. I mean, it's going to be pretty hard for them. Forget the Obamas. I mean, they're sort of at arm's length kind of thing. How hard do you think it's going to be for them tomorrow at this thing?
I think it's going to be very hard. I mean, why would you want to touch him? But he's going to be there, so I guess you have to shake his hand.
We only have time for one more.
Okay, let's go to Robert in Jamaica Plain. Hi, Robert.
Hi, hello, Robert. What's up?
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Just wanted to comment on two quick things. One is, I think earlier you were asking about the reason why Bush has decided to include the president. And I think, you know, from my experience, I voted for him in 1988. I always thought he was a quintessential gentleman. And the reason I didn't vote for him in 92 was essentially Pat Buchanan's culture war speech.
Mm-hmm.
If you recall it at the 92 GOP convention.
Yeah.
I mean, it completely turned me to the Democratic Party. I completely went hard left. It just was such a unbelievably shocking speech to watch. Anyway, with that in mind, the comment I wanted to make is, have you ever watched when Trump appears in church and everybody is praying? And, if you're a religious person, you usually close your eyes and you have some solemn moments that you're you're reflecting and you're praying, right? This guy, Trump, cannot keep his eyes shut. He's like a little kid looking around, and he did it yesterday when he was viewing the remains of George Bush. It's like, you know, he shakes his head. He's like, okay, you're there. I mean, it's so absurd to watch the guy. He doesn't even know how to act in a solemn, respectful way.
Yeah, and we were watching. And you also know, if you were watching his lips carefully when he was doing that, he was quietly chanting, lock her up. Did you notice that at the... That's not true. I just want to see if Marjorie's paying attention, which she sort
paying,
of is.
I was paying
Robert,
attention.
Thank you very much for your phone call.
We're going to end this with Allison. She says, thanks what for this discussion. I'm almost changing my mind about the invitation for all the wrong reasons. The possibility that 41 invited the current occupant just to make him squirm is more than intriguing. She hopes President Trump has a really uncomfortable day tomorrow.
Thanks for your calls.
So we shall see. Okay, we are moving on. We're going to talk with Jacques Pepin and his son-in-law, and Raleigh Wesson, who are here to celebrate 30 years of culinary arts. We're going to hear about a great new book that Jacques Pepin has out and a bunch of other stuff next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The author Ernestine Ulner famously said, life is uncertain, eat dessert first. Our philosophy here at Boston Public Radio is life is uncertain, have Jacques Pepin on first. The chef, author, instructor, TV host, legend, original founder, along with Julia Child, by the way, of Boston University's trailblazing culinary arts certificate program, which is celebrating its 30th year now, is here. He also has a new book out called Menus, a book for your meals and memories. Of course, dessert wouldn't be complete without Raleigh Wesson. He's a professor of culinary arts at Johnson & Wales. He also happens to be Jacques Pepin's son-in-law. Raleigh and Jacques, it is a pleasure to see you again. And by the way, with Claudine, your daughter, the Jacques Pepin Foundation. Great to see you both.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with what we are celebrating, your 30th year here in Boston doing this culinary arts program. Tell people about what this is.
Well, this is the culinary program at the beginning was larger than now. I used to teach for 5 different departments, the School of Hospitality, Metropolitan College, a certification program. Then in the 80s with Julia, we created a graduate program in the culinary art, that is a master of liberal art with a concentration in gastronomy. And to my knowledge, it still doesn't exist in any other place than here. I mean, actually, we wanted to do that undergraduate at the time, but Dr. Silbert at the time decided to do that for the graduate class. And it's interesting because at some point in my life, I was doing a doctorate at Columbia University, and that was my doctoral dissertation, History of Food in the Context Civilization Literature. But that was 1970, and 1970, they say, you cannot write about food, you crazy.
So, Raleigh, tomorrow night, even though it's sold out, we should say there is a huge event honoring the 30 years, celebrating the 30 years for a pretty good cause, yes?
There is. It's terrific. It's going to be at the Hotel Commonwealth, and our local chef, Jeremy Sewell, is the host. We have a bunch of great chefs from Ming Tsai to Jamie Bissonette to
25.
Tony Maz.
25 chefs.
Stephanie Izard from Chicago is here. Renee Erickson from Seattle. It's going to be really, really terrific. And the event is raising money for the culinary certificate program at BU. They're working on renovating their kitchen there.
It's fabulous. You know, Jacques, you mentioned a minute ago you have 25 chefs. Is that what you said?
Right.
Now, since you're in charge, I don't know if you can make an exception for a 26th chef. You've probably heard in your world travels about Marjorie Egan's chicken chicken marabella with prunes. Do you think there's any way you could slip her in?
If she bring a bottle of wine, it's
perfect.
Intermezzo.
You know, the thing that we talked to you about this last time you were here, which one of the things I most admire about your work, describe this New England Center for Arts and Tech. You're doing this thing on Friday.
Yes.
And what the goal is. You've been working forever to basically provide opportunities in the culinary world for, I guess, what we call euphemistically underemployed people.
Yes.
Describe what the agenda is, what the goal is.
Well, I'm going to let Rolly do that because he's the president of that. He organized it, and he knows better than I do.
Well, you say what it is, and then I want you to say, Jacques, why it matters so much to you. Okay, fair enough?
Well, it's really terrific. I mean, what we do through the foundation is we support community kitchens that offer free life skills and culinary training to adults that suffer high barriers to employment. So these are adults who have suffered some sort of trauma, they've been homeless, they have substance abuse, previously incarcerated, and really there's no path for them to get back into the workforce. And we see this as a great win-win-win for the individual who gains some skills, for society who gets someone back into the workforce, and for food service, because food service is desperate for workers and very welcoming. One of the things that we love about food service is that once you put on that coat, nothing else matters. It doesn't matter the color of your skin, where you came from, your history. You show up, you do the work, you're welcomed. And so we think this is a great opportunity.
And why does this matter so much to you?
Of course. Well, I have been a chef. Next year is going to be 70 years. Left home in 1949. Uh-huh. And home with a restaurant anyway. But you have to give back, and there is no better way of giving back. You cannot cook indifferently. You have to put a lot of love in what you do. And to bring people back into the fold of society, you know, it's great. I mean, homeless people, you know, people who have been in jail. So it's great. I mean, to give them some pride, something proud to be. And that's what we do, because I've done so many book and especially tape of technique. So, you know, Rod is organizing a whole program to give to the soup kitchen, because no one does exactly the same thing, to try to get a kind of standardization to what we should teach.
How has this worked out, too? I mean, the giving people this opportunity, the second chance, is, I think, a beautiful and important thing. But did the end results suggest that it was worth the effort, either of you, Jacques or Rolling?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. These community kitchens, and there's over 150 that we've identified across the country. Oh. They're in every community across the country. The vast majority of them have employment rates that are above 85-90% for their graduates. Mm. And what we've been doing is providing source materials like Jacques' cookbooks and technique videos. We do fundraisers that support the organization. So this last June, we did a collaborative event with the Rhode Island Food Bank. We raised $130,000 that went directly to them to support their kitchen. And so it's really been enormously rewarding. And to see the smile on these people's faces, I mean, these are people that are willing to work, that want to work, that are trying to find a way back into society, and culinary arts is a perfect pathway.
We're talking to Raleigh Wieson. He's a professor of culinary arts at Johnson & Wales, and Jacques Pepin's son-in-law. We're also talking to legendary chef Jacques Pepin. Now, before we get any further, I want to talk about this book. It's Christmas time. I think it's time to sell some books, because this is a very clever thing and sentimental thing that you've done, I think, for families. Tell us about My Menus, Remembering Meals with Friends and Family. You said I got the wrong one, but I like this one a lot.
Okay, good. Okay. Well, I've been married 52 years, going on 53, and my wife and I decided, after a year or two of marriage, I just started with Craig Claiborne when he was the food editor of the New York Times. Actually, we get married in his house in 1966. Oh. And he had a book of menu, and each time that I went there, I did a little drawing and wrote the menu. So we decided to do that. And over half a century later, we have 12 books at home, and I can see my mother, my two brothers, many people who are gone. Claudine, my daughter, I can see what she had on her third birthday going in those books. She even did the drawing herself with little friend. So, you know, when we have a good bottle of wine, we take the label to stick it in there. We sometimes put the music we play there and the menu, the friend, and they all do some note on the other side. So, actually, my whole life is those 10 books of menu are in there, you know. So
I think that is one of the most wonderful ideas, and I wish I'd thought of it when I was younger, but I have children, so I can make up for this with them.
Yes.
But to have the handwriting, especially of someone who's no longer there, you know, their handwriting or guests that you had,
it's really an
emotional thing.
And also, if you go to a restaurant, a couple of weeks ago, I was at Daniel in New York. I took my book of menu. Mm-hmm. We wrote the menu and asked the chef to sign it. So you can take it with you, because it's a question of getting those memories, you know, together.
Now, you also mentioned...
This is the book that Oprah... Did you mention... Is this not the book that Oprah said?
It's on... Exactly. Yeah. Oprah's put this... Well, Oprah has good taste, of course. So do I have good taste on these kinds of things. You just mentioned something, Jacques Pepin, about music to go with a meal. How do you determine... If I were coming to your house for dinner, what would you play? The music?
Well, I'll probably start with either Edith Piaf or Yves Montand, some old French song.
Okay.
And I get into jazz. I love jazz. And from Ella Fitzgerald to others, and sometimes we go to classical music, depending on the people, whether they like it or not, and how much noise we make, and so forth.
So how much does that matter, the music accompanying a meal?
Well, it's a background, just like the wine.
Yeah.
Not quite as good as the wine, but good enough.
Okay. So can we talk about family, which I know matters a lot to you, just for the next couple? I want to start with you, Raleigh. I was watching this PBS interview with you in the last 24 hours. And as you know, we all know you married his daughter, Claudine. And you say you never felt you're in competition with him. And by the way, you're a chef, we should say, in addition to your other responsibilities. Yeah. And here's a little bit of what you had to say in this public broadcasting special. Here it is.
No one will ever be like him again. No one will ever have the force that he had on the world of culinary arts that he had. And so for that reason, there was no competition. I was never going to be that good, not even close. I wasn't even going to, if I could get him to maybe like my food a little bit, then that would be an accomplishment. And that's really all I could hope for.
So that's what I want to know. Did you ever get him to like your food a little bit? Yes.
Well, Thanksgiving. He did Thanksgiving.
I want to hear from him. You're too nice a guy.
I'm doing Christmas, and he did Thanksgiving.
And how did how did he do?
Well, your turkey was really fantastic. I don't know, you got it in a farm or somewhere?
Yeah, it was a local farm in Rhode Island.
And, you know, it wasn't overcooked. The breast was perfect. It was really good.
Well, so is this intimidating or not?
Well, so no. It's absolutely true.
I'm a glutton. So.
It's absolutely true that I've never felt in competition. I've never really felt intimidated, sometimes terrified.
I can understand that, yeah.
But not actually intimidated. And the truth is that Jacques is a lover of food, and really you can put anything down in front of him and he'll enjoy it, and he's always been gracious, and he's a great teacher. He, you know, when he comes to our house for Thanksgiving and holidays now, I'll be doing the cooking and he'll be sitting there and say, oh, you could do this little thing and that little thing. So I'm constantly learning from him.
Okay, staying in family for a minute. Yeah. We had the pleasure, Jacques, of meeting your incredible granddaughter about a year or so ago, Shori, who you wrote a cookbook with, which is my speed, by the way. That cookbook is perfect for my level of cooking. But you, there's a great story we read about you. You took her to the White House for an Easter egg roll.
Right.
There was a bit of a problem, was there not?
Kerfuffle.
What happened?
There was not really any problem. We were there. There was John Lithgow, there was Yamaguchi, a bunch of quote celebrity, and I cooked with Michelle Obama in the organic garden, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and then after that, they said, "Do you want to take a picture with the president?"
Well, of Michelle course, Obama says
yeah,
to you,
well,
"Yeah."
I don't know if it's her or someone else. So we all went to the Oak Room, and I was with Claudine, my daughter, Shore, my granddaughter. Then the president came with his two daughters. And the dog, Bo. So they said, so we want to take the picture. Bo loved me, probably smelled my dog. No difference between me and the president. In any case, and the lady who was in charge of security was a bit older, maybe not older than me, but than the other people. So she knew very well the show that I did with Julie and so forth. So we talked a great deal. So we were in front, we were there when we left, and all of a sudden in front of us, the door closed. So I said, what happened? She said, well, we have a situation, we're looking for someone. I said, situation at the White House? Pretty exciting. What's going on? So she said, no, we've been looking for someone. So they stay outside, and after 5 minutes they came, they said, did anyone have an operation in the hospital last week? No one did. So then they left again. 5 minutes later, they come back and say, did anyone have any tests in the White House last week? I said, well, I did. That was on Monday. And on the Thursday before, I had a stress test, you know, so they inject you. And my doctor told me, you cannot kiss a pregnant woman for an hour. We were an hour. So otherwise, it should be. Well, by then, I had been to 3 airports. No one detected me. But they must have serious equipment there because they said they've been following me from the morning through the garden and all of that.
Because you'd had a stress test.
Yes, and then this.
Radiation.
They put a machine on me.
Oh.
Yeah, they put a machine on me and say, you were injected with this, and that. So they called my doctor, actually, and they say, Dr. Mukherjee, a friend of mine, too. And he says, this is the White House. He said, yeah, sure, the White House.
That is incredible.
Isn't it? Yes. So,
you know, you just mentioned something. I know you've lived in America for a long time, been in New England for a long time, but you're from France, and you talked about the president's dog, Bo. You know, I'm not a world traveler, but I've been to Paris a few times, and so have you, Jim. You see a lot of dogs in restaurants.
Good.
What is that about the French with their dogs? Because, of course, you can't do that in the United States.
Yeah, but what is the American without the dog in the restaurant?
Yeah.
I mean, there is nothing wrong with your dog. I mean, they sit next to you. My parents had a restaurant when I was a kid. We already had a couple of dogs, and they sit there, and other people come with their dog. The dogs sit down. They are very civilized.
And no one get upset about it.
No one get upset about it.
Yeah. It's kind of a nice thing to be able to go out to dinner with your dog, provided he's not a beggar, and he's going to try to eat all the food, right?
Right.
You have to have him well-behaved.
So, Jacques, we had a discussion last week about a story that had been written talking about regional cuisine in the United States.
Right.
And saying there's New York cuisine, there's Seattle cuisine, there's New Orleans cuisine, but there's no real New England cuisine, was at least the theory of the writer. And obviously you're a New Englander now as much as you're a Frenchman. Do you agree with that? Do you agree
no,
that there's...
No, I totally disagree with that. I was 10 years director of research for Howard Johnson.
I know that.
So what about the clam chowder? What about the Boston baked beans? What about the lobster roll? What about... You know, there is many, many, many of that, of course. But, I mean, there is no place in the world like America. I mean, 24,000 restaurants in New York. The amount of ethnicity, the people that we meet is... just amazing. I mean, for me, 70 years in the kitchen, I often go and feel that I don't know anything about cooking. I mean, you can probably do a book with 10,000 recipes just for chicken if you go from Turkey to West Africa to whatever. So it's just about amazing. There is no place in the world where you have that type of ethnicity.
You know, speaking of lobster, oh, go ahead.
Well, I would argue that the reason...
You also teach in New England, I just realized, in addition to all your other work,
I do, and I think a lot about cuisine, and one of the things I would say about American cuisine is that because we're so good at distribution, our cuisine is diluted, right? We see a lot of California product. We see a lot of product from the South. And so everywhere you go, the cuisine is diluted from these products that are coming from other parts of the country.
Yeah,
I would say that right
true.
Now we're actually moving in the other direction where chefs are all trying to get as local ingredient as they possibly can, which means that if you're in New England, then it's lobster and it's cod and it's sole and it's clams and mussels that come from the Northeast and mushrooms, wild mushrooms. I mean, I think that the idea of regional cuisine is actually growing in America right at the moment, led by these chefs that are all about farm to table.
That's good.
You know, we had a couple of gentlemen the other day, the lobster roll guys, and I wondered, you're both New Englanders now, you're supposed to do the mayonnaise with the lobster roll, or what's the deal?
Lobster roll for me is hot with butter.
Melted butter.
That's a Connecticut thing, actually.
Yeah. And it's done on the Philadelphia roll, the roll for the hot dog.
Oh, yes.
And it has to be brown on each side.
Amen.
And then the lobster in the middle, melted butter, cracked paper.
I like that roll, but I like the lobster with the mayonnaise.
You do?
Yeah.
Yeah, people debate about that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you probably know that Jose Andres has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I read where you had once dined. I don't know if you were both there or just you were there. You dined at his house.
The day before yesterday.
Yes, really?
We were just with him, yeah.
Oh, tell us.
Jose is amazing. We're first, as a culinarian and the food community, we are so proud of Jose, what he's done with World Central.
Tell people what he's done.
So World Central Kitchen is his foundation. It's been around for a number of years, but it really came to prominence last summer after the hurricane went through Puerto Rico. And Jose took his team down there, and they organized the chefs there on the island, and they made literally hundreds of thousands of meals. I mean, it was really speaking to the power of chefs to organize, to be disciplined, to create movement. I mean, Jose has an enormous amount of energy, so he takes that everywhere he goes, but his desire to help and his heart is just bursting out of his chest. It's amazing.
But it was just a campfire in California,
he was
obviously.
Just there. He came back just when we had dinner Saturday night at his house.
So tell us what you had dinner Saturday night. What did you eat at his house, remember?
He had three of his chefs in the kitchen. Everyone was cooking. We started with tripe. Tripe and pig's feet.
Actually, that was a big thing, is that he did the meal backwards. Usually chefs think of you go lighter to heavier through the meal, and he specifically decided to start heavy and work back towards light. So we started with tripe, and we ended up with caviar.
Yeah, he said that he learned that in Brillat-Savarin, Physiology of Taste. I didn't know that. But we had an incredible meal and some fantastic wine with it. And the company, you know, the table is a great equalizer. I mean, if you're invited, you don't know the guest. You may be seated next to the president of General Motors, which in normal time he never talked to you, but at the table he doesn't know you are. So, you know, the table is a big equalizer and the kitchen too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Speaking of great equalizer, you know that Jose Andres is not exactly fond of the president of the United States. Well, he's been involved in some litigation. Did you ever run into Donald Trump in your New York days there, Jacques Pepin?
Yes, I did. I mean, a couple of times at the Plaza in New York, his wife, was there. And I did
what was that like?
A couple of things. Fine. I mean, for me, I say hello to fine. I never really had any direct contact with it. But my friend who worked with me, Alain Sayac in New York, was the executive chef there.
And really?
I talked to him about him. And he said that when he worked with him, he was very... a very nice person. He was never derogatory about anything. Mm. So I said, well, what happened to him?
But he also eats his steak
with
ketchup. Well done, with ketchup.
Well, also the fact that Alain was telling me,
that's
because
suspicious.
At that time he was taking the plane with him to go to Mar-a-Lago most of the time to do business deal of like 10, 12, 15 people. So he said, we did very great menu, caviar, foie gras, I mean, expensive stuff. That's the way it is. But he says the president always, or Donald Trump at the time, always came to me and said, could you make me some spaghetti and meatball?
You know, before you guys, Raleigh, tell if people want to learn more about the foundation, which I know is the central cause in Jacques' life with his daughter and with you, explain where do people find it? Where can they learn more about it?
Well, we're definitely on the internet. You can find us at jp.foundation. And we've got some really exciting programming coming up in 2019. We've been on this path to provide these materials to community kitchens all across the country, but we have a grant program coming up in 2019 where we're going to be offering $10,000 grants to community kitchens that are trying to develop their programs. Our next big independent event is going to be our second annual Founders Dinner, which will be April 4th.
Is that in New York City?
In New York City.
Mm-hmm. The Yale Club. Yes.
And the beneficiary of that event is going to be the New York City Food Bank. They currently have a sort of impromptu culinary training program, but they want to formalize that, so we're going to be helping them build out their kitchen and develop their curriculum, and so that's going to be a really great thing to do.
Congratulations to both of you and Claudine.
Thank you.
It's wonderful
thank you
work.
Very much.
Yeah, thank
great
you
to see you both again. We're
this
looking forward
thank
to tomorrow
you.
Night.
Oh,
we cannot
sure
wait.
Are.
Yeah, we're going to have a great...
Jim is bringing aluminum foil.
Can I put aluminum foil in my pockets and just fill them? Yes, John?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And Friday, I'm doing another dinner in another room for La Chaîne des Rôtisseurs. Again, to provide dinner for an organization.
Scholarships,
Fabulous. Yeah. Congratulations on it all. It's great to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Is a professor of culinary arts at Johnson & Wales. Jacques Pepin is a chef, TV personality, and author, along with Julia Child, the original founder of BU's Trailblazing Culinary Arts Certificate Program, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary. His latest book, Menus, a book for your meals and memories. Thank you very, very much for coming in.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Up next, Carol Rose from the ACLU is going to join us. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, about two-thirds of all inmates have a substance abuse disorder. And for the first time, a federal judge has ruled it's unconstitutional to deny them the treatment they need to manage their addiction. We talked to the ACLU's Carol Rose about their litigation on this and the far-reaching implications it has for inmates here and beyond across the country. Then we talked to sports authority Trini Kuznarek about Kansas City Chiefs, who have belatedly come up with a groundbreaking way to handle players' bad behavior, firing him.
Ever wonder why a wait person got your order wrong? Maybe because they couldn't hear you. Thanks to modern-day decor, restaurants are getting louder and putting the din in dinner. We'll talk to food writer Corby Kimmerer about this and more. Then CNN's John King is here to go over the latest political headlines. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Braddy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Tuesday. We are broadcasting, as we do every Tuesday, from the Boston Public Library.
Why don't you explain what the problem was there, Marjorie?
Well, I came back here with the bathroom key.
Which is really...
that other people might need the bathroom key.
Not to be done.
So, but luckily, Chelsea... took the bathroom key from me, and everything is all set now.
In any case, she's out of breath, but here. So Boston Police Commissioner Willie Gross, the new commissioner, vowed to pave a smoother path between the police department and the community. But some stumbling blocks have been laid down along the way as he and the ACLU find themselves in a bit of a flap. Joining us to elaborate on the ACLU's lawsuit against the Boston Police and Willie Gross's response. By the way, he will be with us to start his regular monthly appearances on January 18th. He called the ACLU paper warriors. Well, the leader of the paper warriors is here. That'd be Carol Rowe. She's the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Carol, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
Thank you very much, Carol, for coming in. So tell everyone how this began. What is it that the ACLU lawsuit involving the Boston Police is all about?
Sure. So it's the ACLU on behalf of six other groups. So there's a lot of people, not just the ACLU, that are suing. You know, it's the Children's Law Center, Greater Boston Legal Services, Justice Center, Muslim Justice League, National Lawyers Guild, and the PEAR Project. So there's a group of allies that are working on this. And mostly it's a lawsuit basically to get information. It's a public records lawsuit. We asked for information about how the Boston Police Department's gang's database works, not individual names of members in the gang, but rather information about the demographics, where do they collect the information, who's in, you know, gross numbers about who's in the database, and things like that, in part because in other cities and towns where this has been used, it's been shown to really reflect serious racial disparities in Chicago and Oakland and other places. So we just wanted to get more information. So initially we asked for the information back in May of 2018, and we didn't get a response. So under the public records law in Massachusetts, you file a complaint against the officials in charge, that would be Commissioner Gross in this case, simply to get the information, the aggregate information about whether or not the gang's database is effective, is it keeping us safe, who's in it. You know, some of the things that we learned from the Oakland and Chicago is sometimes, you know, one-year-olds were accidentally getting in the database, and people, there was no way to get out of the database. And that's one thing we know here is that it's a secret database. It's very easy to get in. There's a point system. So if you're wearing a Chicago Bulls hat, you can get 4 points. If you're seen with another person wearing the hat, that's another 4 points. And, you know, if your family member is in the gang's database and you're associating with them, that's another 4 points. So suddenly you're at 10 and you get in the database and there's no way to get out. And that's really concerning because in our system of democracy, you have a due process protection. So you have a right to find out if the government has put you into a gang database, and then if it's wrong, to correct it.
Right. Is this about MS-13 or is this about any gang?
It's about any gang.
Any gang.
And whoever they define as a gang. Again, we don't know. So it's hard for us to say it's either a good or a bad tool for law enforcement because we just don't know. So what we're really looking for is transparency, is more information, rather than saying that it's inherently good or bad. We simply don't have the information.
And Willie Gross, as I think most people listening know, on his personal, not on the police Facebook page,
right,
pretty much fought back big time, again, describing the ACLU as paper warriors, talking about all the tough spots that he and other officers are in. You don't see the ACLU there. Pretty, I would argue, pretty disparaging.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor was here, obviously his boss, the man who picked him the other day, and I think it's fair to say, and Marjorie, if I am misrepresenting what Mayor Walsh said, please correct me. I think Mayor Walsh, who sounded pretty conciliatory about this whole thing, said something like, I really hope that the two sides can get together. I prefer to see, you know, if there's a problem that the police commissioner has with the ACLU or vice versa. And now I'm putting words in his mouth, but this was the thrust of his message. I hope they just sit down and talk rather than having these public kinds of things. Has that happened? Are you willing to do that?
Sure, yeah.
You're willing to, but it hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened yet, but we're willing to, and we've reached out hoping that it will happen.
You have? And what kind of response have you got?
Yeah, I think there's a willingness both by the commissioner and the mayor
to meet
and talk to the ACLU.
But there's no date or anything yet?
Not yet.
It's okay, fine.
No, but, you know, one thing I want to say is, you know, we really, the ACLU, we're a free speech organization, so we really appreciate and defend Commissioner Gross's right to make his statements known, you know, his views, and we appreciate the role of measured criticism. I mean, we dish it out as well as receive it. So we never took this very personally. But I do think it's important that if Commissioner Gross doesn't understand what the ACLU does, that other people, all of us need to understand what it does, because it's such an important organization and started here in Massachusetts, right, nationwide. It's almost 100 years ago.
But wait a minute, but he totally, obviously, he's been around a long time. He obviously understands what you do. So well, I don't understand it. Obviously, I'll ask him directly in January. What do you think provoked this? I mean, he's used to contentiousness in the world and courtrooms his whole career.
Yeah, I mean, you should ask him because I don't know. And one of the things I do want to make a point, though, is that we really are on the front lines, ACLU advocates, in addition to being in the courthouse. I mean, we were on the front lines with the Muslim ban. We were out at the airport.
Logan, right? I remember very well.
You know, but we also have ACLU staff that's been going down to El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras and other places. So we know firsthand what Central American immigrants and young people are facing, and we bring that perspective to our work. So I think it's important for people to realize that we're on the front lines, not to mention the fact that I'll just say that some of my staff were pretty upset because they've served in the military and they felt pretty offended to be accused of not being actual people who were willing to be on the front lines.
Can I ask one more thing about this?
Like the rest of the country, the ACLU represents a wide cross-section of people.
Is there a backstory here that we don't... I mean, for example, again, I don't know Willie Gross personally at all. I've probably met him 5 times in my life. I've heard only really good things about him. I've seen him, as we described in the air, being screamed at by demonstrators and keeping totally calm. Is there a history with Gross and the ACLU?
You know, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I will be really honest with you. We were blindsided by this.
Okay.
You know, I've heard that there was he put in his note that there was some
Facebook post, yeah.
In his Facebook post that there was a shooting that ACLU staff were. That's there were no ACLU people there that I'm aware of. And we wouldn't be down. I don't understand. There might be people who live in the community who work for the ACLU or did work for the ACLU happen to be there, but there was nobody there on behalf of the ACLU as such. That's the only thing that he referenced in his post. But no, we were really surprised by it. I mean, this is the rough and tumble of being a police commissioner. And, you know, when the ACLU sues people, it's in their professional capacity. It's not a personal lawsuit against the commission.
So a meeting is in the works, and we'll hear about that.
Hopefully. Sure hope so.
I hope so, too.
Yeah.
We're talking to Carol Rose, the head of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts.
So, Carol Rose, yesterday Governor Baker called on court officials to remove this Newton District Court judge, Shelley Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a federal grand jury examining whether court personnel, including this judge, allowed this person who's here illegally, who'd been twice deported, apparently he has multiple aliases, to sneak out a rear courtroom door. There are two issues here and he got away from ICE people that were mm-hmm. in the courtroom hoping to deport him.
Well,
the presumption
detain him,
is,
at least. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's two issues here. One, that he's went out a back door and got away, and two, that apparently there was a span during which the judge said to the court reporter, shut off the tape recording, and they had a sidebar. So what do you
about this very topic?
Yes.
Right.
So what do you make of this?
I have a twofold response to that, Marjorie. I mean, first, even judges get due process under our system of government. So I'm a little alarmed that the governor would be trying to remove the person he appointed to the judiciary mm-hmm. without waiting for the process for the investigation to take place. We don't know what happened. I certainly don't know what happened, and neither does the governor. So that he would be calling already for her to step down without waiting for the process to play out is a little concerning.
But he's not, in all fairness to the governor, my understanding is he's not suggesting she step down permanently. He's suggesting that she step down from criminal matters while an investigation proceeds. That's a little different.
I don't think it is. I mean, I think he needs to understand that, you know, he appointed this person. They're appointed
just last year,
for life.
Actually,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just don't think that it's appropriate for him to be already impugning her integrity until we know the facts, and we don't know the facts. And then the second thing is I'm a little concerned. I really think that the governor would be better off really focusing his energy on protecting Massachusetts communities from ICE and protecting the courts in particular and other institutions from being undermined by the Trump administration. I mean, here we are. We're 2 years into the Trump administration with their incredible, cruel attacks on undocumented people in our midst. And, I mean, the only thing we can do is pick a fight with a state court judge. How about instead, like, affirming that the 10th Amendment actually says that no state official can be commandeered, you know, to assist the Trump deportation machine? Or how about urging the Trump administration to stay away from Massachusetts courts and, you know, to stop its racism so state judges can do their job? I mean, there are a lot of political statements that the governor of Massachusetts could issue, and I would say that access to justice for undocumented people would behoove the governor to say that perhaps we want ICE not to be in our courtrooms because we want people to come forward as witnesses, to come forward if they have criminal charges against them, whatever. And when ICE people keep hanging around the courtrooms, the state courthouses, it really creates a problem of access to justice. So I just think, as a political matter, I think it would be better if the governor took that up rather than not weighing in for 2 years and then suddenly weighing in to attack a state court judge that he appointed.
Well, he has weighed in to say he's fine with individual cities and towns declaring themselves to be sanctuary cities. He just doesn't support the statewide thing. But let's leave Baker out of this. I know Marjorie broached that a minute ago. The underlying notion, if the facts are as we're told them in the Globe, even though I know you don't want to see ICE officials in courtrooms, and nor do I, they were in the courtroom, and my understanding is they are legally there. What do you think of the judge, assuming this is all true, the judge, I think it's fair to use the word conspiring, to allow this guy to exit a back door. What do you think of that?
I just don't know that that's what the judge did, Jim. I really don't want to weigh in on that because we don't have any evidence that that's what actually happened because, in fact, it was turned off. The microphone was turned off, so I don't know what happened.
I think your microphone is turned off, too, by the way. Is it? There
okay,
it is.
Sorry.
Keep going.
So I don't know what happened, and we don't know what happened. So I'm really loath to begin to, make pronouncements about what the judge did right or did wrong. But I do think it's a very, very serious issue that ICE and federal immigration officials are interfering with the right of people to access the system of justice in this country. And it would be really scary if we started then going after and trying to commandeer state court judges or other state officials to collaborate with ICE.
But isn't this one of these problems where state and local, federal and local law are in conflict? Is that not where we stand? Putting aside your position on the policy, as a matter of law, that's why we have the sort of like marijuana, actually.
Well, by law, under the 10th Amendment, you cannot commandeer state officials to do the work of ICE agents. So that's why it's possible for local communities or for the state to pass a law saying that local police officers will protect and serve the communities that they're hired to protect
without
and
violating
serve,
federal law by doing that.
Without violating federal law. They are not compelled under the 10th Amendment to be commandeered to do the work of the Trump deportation.
Let me just ask you a question about this, though, that I don't really understand how this happens. I mean, are ICE people just hanging around in courtrooms all around the state? Or did they have some advance notice that someone who'd been twice deported was coming into this Newton courtroom? Somebody dropped a dime?
Both.
I mean, I'm curious.
From what we're hearing is both. That sometimes they're just hanging around, and other times they're looking over the court docket and comparing it against their lists. And so it's happening in all sorts of ways.
Is that legal to overlook the court docket?
Well, it's a public document, so I think it may be hard to challenge that. But I also think the other thing that's happening that's really concerning is people who are being held in ICE custody haven't been being permitted to go to their court hearings if they have, like, a misdemeanor charge or something. And because they don't show up, then it becomes a more serious crime, and then they're deported because they have a serious crime. So the ACLU of Massachusetts has, in fact, filed a couple of lawsuits saying that if someone's held in ICE custody, they have to be taken to their hearing in the courts because ICE was refusing to do that.
Look at this little baby outside the window waving. Oh, my God.
We're on the radio, Jim.
I know, but it's just really... one last thing about this. I don't know what the answer... I don't know who's where. I know a bill has been filed to make Massachusetts a sanctuary state, and I think I'm correctly describing the governor's position that he says individual cities and towns do what they want and don't support the state thing. Do you have any idea where the new Senate president is and where the Speaker of the House is on this issue?
You know, I don't actually know where they are. It's up in the air, but I do think it's important not to call it a sanctuary. There's no sanctuary from committing a crime. What this is saying is that we're not required as state officials, they're not required to collaborate. And, if you think about, what happened, like, frankly, during, Nazism and when the U.S. initially was refusing to let immigrants come who were trying to flee persecution in Nazi Germany, that was a lesson that we learned in this country, that we wanted to be a welcoming country and we didn't have to collaborate. Well, now we have our very own government who's targeting people who haven't committed any crime because overstaying a visa is not, in fact, a crime. And our local towns and cities don't need to collaborate. We're not required to under the Constitution.
Why is that not
collaborate.
Sanctuary? What's pejorative about the notion of sanctuary?
I think sanctuary implies that people are going to be given sanctuary who've committed a crime.
I see.
And this is really not
Which,
that.
By the way, is I think the way a lot of people understand it.
Right, and people don't understand.
They think that,
that
rapists and murderers are getting sanctuary, which is not.
That's not the case.
It's been explained to me as people that have not committed serious crimes.
And in fact, I would even go further and say that the public safety really would urge us all to have welcoming cities, because we want people to come forward and see the police as people they can report crimes to if they're victimized or if they've witnessed a crime. We want people to come forward, and the vast majority of people who are here who are undocumented live in mixed families where some people are U.S. citizens and some people are not, and we want people to be able to come forward and report crimes because that keeps us safe.
We're talking to Carol Rose from the
ACLU. That is correct, Marjorie.
We talked to Andrea Cabral, who used to run the Suffolk County lockup when she was the sheriff of Suffolk County, about providing methadone to inmates who've gotten put in jail and they have opioid problems. And she was talking about how when she ran the sheriff's office, basically people would come in and they just go through these pretty vicious withdrawals, which happens with opioid addiction. But this first in the country ruling may be changing that, not just here, but possibly.
And it's your case, right? Is it
not
your case?
Yeah, this is an ACLU case. This is a really important case and a victory that we just had. We filed a lawsuit on September 19th, along with the law firm of Goodwin Proctor, basically challenging the denial of medication-assisted treatment, methadone. For a man named Jeffrey Pesci. He's a 30-year-old. And Mr. Pesci had battled substance use disorder for many years, but he's been on the mend, and he's been able to function and be reunited with his family and have a job and do all these things because his doctor prescribed methadone, and that has been working for him for the last 2 years. He was picked up for driving without a license, in part because he was going to get his methadone, and his mother was sick that day and couldn't drive him that day to get his methadone. And so he is now facing a mandatory 60-day sentence. And so what's happening is where he was going to go, where in the Essex County House of Correction, he wouldn't be allowed to continue his methadone, even though his doctor had prescribed it. So the ACLU said, oh, that doesn't seem right. So we filed a challenge to this refusal to give him medication that his doctor prescribes under both the Americans with Disabilities Act and under the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Right. And so we actually won. On October 26th, the federal judge said, no, he actually has to be given his methadone if they're going to lock him up. And this is important because, you know, people who are discharged from prison are 120 times more likely to die of an overdose than the general population. And nearly 50% of all deaths among those released from prison are actually opioid-related. And so that's why the legislature actually just in the last session passed a law creating a pilot program where there would be 5 houses of corrections where this would be offered. Unfortunately, Essex wasn't one of them. And so I think there's a growing awareness and acknowledgement by leaders and policymakers that if we really care about the opioid crisis and the substance abuse crisis in this state and in this country, we're going to have to let people take things like methadone and other forms of medicine to make sure that they can continue to function using opioids.
First of all, the most powerful thing that was surprising to me in the piece the Globe wrote about your litigation, about 2/3 of all inmates have a substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. And obviously methadone is demonstrated to be quite effective. Is the cruel and unusual part of this that a doctor has determined this is medically necessary?
Right.
And when that happens, when you deny a medically necessary treatment, is that what the basis for the Eighth Amendment argument is?
Yeah, so what Judge Casper wrote, in fact, was the treatment known to be ineffective for Pesci could potentially place him at higher risk of relapse and overdose upon release and could make him physically ill for several days while he undergoes forced withdrawal.
You know, do people get antidepressants or mental health medications in prison?
Sure. Yeah,
they
that's the thing. I mean, or think of it if you have diabetes. Like, you can't deny somebody insulin.
Yeah.
So I think it's part of understanding that substance abuse disorder isn't a moral failing. It's actually a disease.
So if you have, like, bipolar disorder or something, you'll be able to get your medicine in prison.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wasn't sure about that. So you're involved in this other suit alleging, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a woman who had very serious physical problems resulting from her opioid addiction or maybe from something else, was arrested by the Springfield cops, and you're alleging did not get the medical health help that she needed?
That's right.
Young woman, 30 years old.
Yeah, she was only 30 years old. Madeline Linsenmeyer out in Springfield. And this story has gotten big press, sort of gone viral internationally.
Well, her obituary.
Because her obituary. Her sister wrote her obituary was so moving. And, you know, so this is a young woman. She also had substance use disorder, like Jeffrey Pesci. And she got picked up. For a probation violation, and she was held, and she called her mother while she was in the police station, and she said, "Mom, I'm suffering. I need medical treatment." Her knee was swollen. She dropped a lot of weight.
She weighed 90 pounds.
Yeah, she weighed 90 pounds, and she said, "I really need medical treatment." And they didn't give her. We don't know what happened, but then she died. And so what we did immediately, representing the family, is to ask to see the recording of what happened, because they do all these things when people are arrested. A lot of what you do is recorded. We want to find out what happened. The family wants to find out what happened so that they can go forward, because they're now becoming advocates for making sure that people get the medical treatment when they're arrested, when they're in the custody of the state, that they get the medical treatment to which they have a right. And again, that we don't see substance use disorder as somehow a moral failing, but rather begin to recognize it as a public health crisis and stop trying to treat it like an incarceration problem.
You know, we talked to, was it the Frontline guys, Jim, that did the thing on methadone? They were talking about how...
It wasn't just on methadone, it was on a whole opioid issue. And the central theme
was
the one you mentioned, that this should be treated as a public health issue.
Because the amount of whatever it is that goes to your brain is like 10 times other sorts of drugs, and your brain chemistry becomes altered, which I found... I certainly did not know that. Here's what I'm dying to know about, because I didn't even know about...
Well, before you leave this, by the way, because for those who didn't see the obituary of this woman, and her last name was Linsenmeyer, and if you
Madeline
were one of the few people who missed
this... She's a mother.
You should really Google it. It is really powerful and actually beautiful and heartbreaking, actually.
So, I didn't know this, but Jim, being a former city council over there in Cambridge...
Not much of a city councilor, but yes, there was.
This.
Thank you.
That people can be prevented from putting up temporary signs...
On their lawns.
On their lawns, which I hadn't thought about. But tell us what's going on with Holyoke and the ACLU's involvement.
Yeah,
and before you do that, there are a ton of communities that ban lawn signs, right? Because they don't want... It's mostly about campaign stuff, isn't it, for the most part? Yeah.
Well, apparently they also ban all are welcome. And
No. I meant, but that's the primary
motivation.
The
wedding ceremony is being held here.
Okay,
right,
fine.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is some of our recent First Amendment victories that actually, given we've been so busy with the other stuff, haven't gotten a lot of press yet. But last week we had a big victory challenging the city of Holyoke's policy prohibiting temporary lawn signs on private property during the winter months. And so our clients wanted to put up things like welcome neighbors signs and Black Lives Matter
signs. I hate
welcome
neighbor signs.
Or Peace on Earth signs.
Or maybe Merry Christmas.
Do you hate the Peace on Earth signs, Jim?
This time of year.
Anyway,
Happy holidays.
And so, you know, so we filed a lawsuit, and on November 28th, the U.S. District Court, the federal court in Springfield, ruled that indeed it is a violation of free speech. If you have private property and you want to put up a sign, even during the winter months, you're allowed to do so.
What is the city? What is Holyoke? Holyoke's mayor is like 14, right? Isn't he? Isn't he like Fort Morse or whatever his name is?
I think he's a little bit older than the mayor of Fall River.
Alex Morse, and he actually vetoed it when the city council did this, and they overrode his veto.
So he was on the right side.
He was on the right side.
But wait a second. So I wasn't trying to blame him. It just came to mind. But I don't know. What possible argument does a city or town make as to why someone on their private property can't post the sign? It's like standing on your front lawn and saying the words.
Right.
Obviously, you can do that. What's the argument?
What they wanted to do was to say that the political campaigns are finite. They didn't want, for example, Mayor Morse to continue to have political signs out on people's front lawns when the political season was over. So I think the attempt was to say, when the political season is over, you have to take down your political sign. But they knew you can't force signs to come down because they don't like the content. Mm-hmm. So they tried to do a blanket ban on signs, but that also was ruled unconstitutional.
Okay, what does temporary mean?
Not permanent.
Not permanent. But it also, by the way, was going to ban bumper stickers.
Yeah, I saw that too.
It's really nutty.
It seemed a little over the top there.
It's a lot over the top. And so, you know, it's important. You know, these First Amendment cases come up, and it's even though the ACLU is a multi-issue organization, it's terribly important that we don't lose our sights on the fact that the First Amendment still is what I call a modal right, a right that underpins all the other rights, enabling us to advocate for equality and immigrants' rights and racial justice and things like that.
Well, before you go, I don't want to give you advice because you're a crack lawyer on your team, but I'll give you a little advice for the next time you have to argue. You can use Marjorie as an example about how important these signs are.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Marjorie is legendary in Brookline, where she lives, voting on the wrong day and going to the wrong polling place. And one of the is that an unfair characterization?
I was a little confused.
Marjorie, would you like me to drive you to the polling?
Thank you.
No, but I'm serious. But a lawn sign saying "vote on a particular day," even if you don't support that candidate, is a value to people like you.
Well, they usually put the, now it's interesting because the signs saying "this is election day" are usually like in the middle of the road somewhere. You see, so I assume the municipality puts those up, right?
Right.
And that's different than having a neighbor put up something. And then my neighbor did put up something, but I wasn't sure if I could have it because it was a political sign, and I'm sort of a reporter, really.
You are a reporter.
I kind of am. And so I asked her if she, I felt bad because I said we shouldn't have it because I'll get in trouble, but...
Okay. You have no idea what you're talking about.
As long
that's okay.
As long as you exercise your right to vote, I think it's fine for reporters not to make it public, but I do think it's important that all people who have the right to vote exercise
their right. On that note, we asked Chuck Todd a couple of weeks ago if he voted, because there are a couple of reporters and anchors who I have great respect for, other than the fact that they make these incredibly pretentious, pathetic arguments about how actually casting a vote will bias them in some ways. Chuck Todd votes, and I'm with you. You have the right to do it. Exercise it.
Absolutely.
Carol Rose, good to see you.
Nice to be here. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Carol Rose. Carol Rose is Executive Director of the ACLU of Massachusetts. She joins us every week. Carol, great to talk to you. Up next, our sports expert, Trenny Kuznarek, joins us for an update on the two men in a race across Antarctica. I can't even believe what these guys are going through. Trenny's going to fill us in. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. And by the way, I just had a new salad dressing from the New Seed Cafe that I've never had
what
before.
What kind is it, Jim?
I have no idea, but it is
looks like ranch
fabulous.
To me.
No, it's not.
It's not ranch.
So with just over a month left in the NFL season, should we be shifting our allegiance from the Patriots and cheer on the Kansas City Chiefs for releasing its star player, Kareem Hunt, who is currently under investigation for kicking a woman and punching someone? Or are the Chiefs guilty of having poor reflexes for failing Dak sooner? That's where my vote would be. Joining us to go over this and other headlines is Trenny Kuznarek. Trenny's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. Trenny Kuznarek, hello there.
Hi, I am in your camp. They deserve no credit. Like, congratulations for releasing a guy months after you knew that he did this and didn't investigate
it. Could you tell that for those three people who didn't follow this, can you explain what happened in the timeline, if you
will? So last February, Kareem Hunt, which is their running back, was involved in a domestic dispute at an apartment complex in Cleveland. It was reported that he kicked and punched his girlfriend. I don't believe charges were filed, they were dropped, as always happens in these cases. And they said they did their due diligence and they looked into it and they didn't find anything, nothing to see here, everybody. And then last week, as is wont to happen, TMZ gets their hands on the video that the NFL just, they couldn't find this video anywhere of the surveillance cameras in the apartment. And what you see is Kareem Hunt getting into it with a number of people. There is him shoving his girlfriend and then someone holding her back and her swiping at him and then him pushing her again and pushing the guy who's trying to hold him back and her so hard that she falls over, then pushing past that guy and kicking her.
Kicks her.
And swinging at her again. And he had numerous times. He was, you know, he didn't just swing at the woman. He also swung at the guy who was trying to contain the situation. It looked like there was at least four or five people involved. But once again, we have this, you know, this issue where this is this any different than Ray Rice? When they said, oh, well, we talked to Ray Rice, and him and his fiance, now wife, fiance at the time, said everything was fine. It was just a domestic dispute. Nothing to see here. No charges were filed. And then we get a video that comes out, and you see Ray Rice cold cocking his girlfriend in a Vegas elevator and dragging her out by her hair. And they vowed that this would never happen again. But it's happened again. And it happens over and over and over again. If you look at the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, in and of themselves, they also have a young man on their team, Tyreek Hill, another very impactful offensive player, kick returner, wide receiver, who was accused of punching his pregnant girlfriend while in college.
You know, let me just say a couple things about this, because this drives me out of my mind. One, the fact that the Chiefs are getting praised because people aren't paying attention. First of all, the Chiefs waited all these months. Two, they say they fired this guy, cut him from the team, because he lied. They didn't fire him for the underlying violence against a woman. Third, the NFL, which is arguably one of the most powerful entities in America, not only did not see the video, they contend, they didn't even interview the player. They didn't even, the Kansas City Chiefs did. They didn't interview the player. And
or,
I'll tell you,
Renee
Graham wrote a great piece in the paper today saying that not only, it was TMZ, as you said, that came up with the first, second video, the Hunt video. It was TMZ who came up with the Ray Rice video. TMZ should be the commissioner of the NFL, not Roger Goodell, for $41 million. This is grotesque. And you know what it's like? It's like the column you wrote yesterday. We only know one. You were talking about Facebook and Amazon and all their sins. Emmett Price, who's one of our reverends, is a huge football fan, does not watch the NFL. I believe it's a combination of concussions, domestic violence, that sort of stuff. This is despicable behavior. And if we're trashing the Catholic Church for not policing itself, then we should be trashing the NFL and doing something about it.
And herein lies the problem, right, is that, and I'm guilty of this because I work in an industry that props up the NFL. It, you know, leads our newscasts almost every single night unless there's a bigger Celtics or Red Sox story. Sorry, Bruins, we usually don't lead with you unless something really crazy happens, like you fire your coach. We talk about them all the time. And even as a woman, I don't watch as much football now as I used to. I mean, I used to sit on my couch from morning until night and watch the NFL, and I loved it, and I was into fantasy football. This year I played fantasy football. I don't know why. My team was terrible. I didn't look into anything. I lost almost all of my games because I just don't care, and I just don't watch games anymore.
Why?
Except for the Patriots.
Why?
Because it's I don't find enjoyment in it anymore.
Because of what?
For a litany of reasons. I don't like watching some guy get the – you know what, beat out of him every time he catches a ball or is at the line of scrimmage. I no longer take joy in a big hit or a quarterback going down. My first thought is, oh, my God, is he going to get up and what's his brain going to be like in 10 years? But I'm also just disgusted by the way the league handles itself. Like, why should I give you my advertising and entertainment dollars? But I'm such a hypocrite. I paid for a ticket to go watch the Packers play the Patriots in Foxborough, partially because my brother was in town and he wanted to go. But you know what? Shame on me for not saying, you know what, Brian, if you want to go, you can go. That's my brother's name. You can go to the game if you want, but I am no longer supporting a league and paying any money to go watch a sport that does not, and I've said this on the show, I've said it on my show on NBC Sports Boston, does not care about women. But to, you know, and putting some of this on women's shoulders, shame on us for continuing to support a product that doesn't care about us.
40, by the way, didn't we say a couple of weeks ago, based on hard data, 40% of people who consume the NFL
are women
in 2018.
Yeah, I'm trying to get some perspective on this. I don't remember this knowing about this kind of thing like 10 years ago.
Well,
so
I mean,
what's going on?
Well, there is a change, right?
Yeah.
There's a change now where 10 years ago we had technology, but not the way that we do now, where you can instantly videotape, you know, someone with your cell phone, easily look up criminal records, get the kind of video. Now I think what's changed it is that information is so at the ready. You know, anybody can be anywhere and take video of it, take a picture of it, and then you have visual proof.
Really,
you know,
does.
Some women who have been abused and who feel that their voices haven't been heard have taken to platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to post pictures of their bruises, of, wounds that they have sustained from these men and say, you know, no one listens to me. Here are the pictures to show because they're not doing their due diligence in prosecuting this kind of stuff. But also it starts with prosecution. It also starts with the way that I think our legal system handles domestic violence. I don't want to go too off tangent, but when I was in Iceland last year, I was talking to someone from there about why they have a very high reporting rate of domestic violence, but overall the number of cases are low. But the part of it is that the reason that the rate of calls and convictions are so high is because when a woman calls in a domestic violence report in the country of Iceland, the police don't just show up. It's the police, a social worker, a psychologist. They send a team of people there so that what doesn't happen? That a woman isn't so terrified and scared that this person is going to kill her or kill her child or take away her, you know, if she's married to this guy and she hasn't worked and she gave up her career to follow someone that she loved and thought she was being supportive of, and then he turns on her once they're married and starts, you know, beating the living hell out of her. Now she has no financial support. So they bring in a support system to make sure that, you know, you have somewhere to go. You have the psychological and sociological pieces there in place that you feel comfortable that you can report someone and leave.
You know, by the way, we should add, we have a little bit of sound here from one of the few people that's spoken about this, Kareem Hunt himself, shortly after he was cut by Kansas City. And he's only a second-year player and was a huge star last year. Wasn't his first game against the Patriots where he ran wild? I think it was his first
game. It might have been last year.
In any case, Here he is speaking on ESPN after the video came out and after he was cut.
It was definitely some things that were said and did that I did not like, and that's not an excuse. It's not. I'm that person in that video did not deserve that. I didn't mean to hurt anybody or anything like that. It's really tough. It's tough because, like, I feel like I let a lot of people down, and I just really want to, you know, apologize to everybody, the Chiefs organization, my family, and close friends.
Now, I have no idea if he means it or not, but you're just to continue.
But notice
this,
that he never apologizes to the woman.
Well,
this
except,
all
no,
the
he
time.
Did say that person in that video did not deserve that. And he should have been more. But can I say one more thing about this? We shouldn't just leave this with Hunt and Ray Rice from whatever 4 years ago. What's the name of the guy from the San Francisco 49ers?
Reuben Foster. Who's
caught
just
for domestic violence, and the Washington Redskins
pick him up
in 2 seconds.
Because the 49ers released him because it was the second time that he was accused of domestic violence,
by the way, yes.
By the same woman. The first time the woman recanted her story, and people say, oh, well, she recanted her story. Do I need to tell you again that oftentimes victims of domestic violence recant their stories for the reasons I listed before?
But you know something? I listened to the Globe's Gladiator podcast about Aaron Hernandez. I thought it was terrific, by the way, people that haven't heard it. And they talked about how when he was at the University of Florida, he was way off the rails then, but how, you know, there'd be some big brawl in the bar. Nothing would happen because they were University of Florida football players and the rules were different. It really occurred to me, a lot of these young men that play sports, I mean, they may not come from the best environments. They, you know, Hernandez had. Well, the colleges, I think, it's different when you're over 21, you're a professional player with the NFL. But the colleges really use and abuse these guys. They know that some of these guys are very troubled, and they do nothing.
Well, they cover it up.
Yeah.
Same as the NFL.
Can't they get a social worker or somebody in there to kind of be in loco parentis, especially when they didn't have any parents, you know, when they were 14 years old?
Because they don't care. I mean, I say that the NFL doesn't care about women, but I would also argue that the NCAA and the NFL don't really care about their players. What indication has either entity given us that they care about the people involved in these programs? These kids, from the time that they show any sort of talent that might be far and above what any other athlete shows, they are shuffled through things. They could get in trouble in high school, and it's pushed under the rug because they're the star pitcher on the baseball team or basketball player or football player. You get to college. We had the incidents at Baylor where there were all of these reported sexual assault cases, and those were what happened to those? Art Bras lost his job because they pushed it. They swept it under the rug. Then what happens at the NFL level? We're surprised then when these guys are beating up women, raping women in college. Woo, then they do it again in the NFL. I mean, and someone in my office brought this up, my producer Steve said, why is it that when a kid gets in trouble in college, there's no ramification in the NFL? So Tyreek Hill, Kareem Hunt had an issue, I think a fight in a bar while he was in college. Joe Mixon, who is with the Cleveland Browns and played at Oklahoma. There's video of him cold cocking a woman in a fast food restaurant late night in college. He's drafted in the first round by the Cleveland Browns. These kids do not pay a penalty for their actions, and no one holds them responsible.
Well, one exception, Myra Kraft. Held somebody responsible.
Christian Peter. That was a long time ago.
Well, it was a long time ago, and obviously she's not with us anymore, but there's somebody who decided that they would stand for principle. We're talking to Trini Kuznarek.
It's so frustrating, and it's like we're broken records. I mean, how many times in the year that I've done this show have we had this conversation, and nothing changes? And Bill Simmons made a good point. Where is Roger Goodell?
Yeah, well, that was
counting his $41 million
of Renee Graham's column, and Roger Goodell
has not said
anything.
Let's
talk about a great story, and you've been following this.
Is this Antarctica?
These two guys racing across.
They're out of their minds.
Antarctica. I just was reading this latest update from the New York Times. I mean,
did you know that they were not even together?
I know it now.
They're separate. Well, I didn't know that
they're
until
miles
this morning.
Apart.
You don't listen to Do you not listen to me when I'm on the show, Jay?
Sometimes I do.
Waking up in the morning with whiteout conditions. It's so
sick.
Hard to see. They have to have a compass around their neck so they know where the hell they're going. But tell us. Plus, they're falling and tripping all the time. They're carrying three.
With no support.
Yeah, tell us what's going
on. Okay, so if you haven't been following this story, there are two gentlemen, and I always forget the second guy's, the older guy's name, because I don't follow him on Instagram, which is terrible. So one is
Lewis
Rudd and Colin O'Brady. Colin O'Brady is like 33 years old, the epitome of fitness, and Lewis Rudd is this, late 50s, early 60s guy who has traversed Antarctica before, but in a supported group. Lewis Rudd decided first he was going to try to be the first person to ever go across the continent of Antarctica unsupported. That means you do not so much as take a cup of hot water when you pass the U.S. Station at the South Pole, like the scientists and researchers. You can't go in to use the bathroom or warm up or shower. You have to do everything on your own. Colin O'Brady decided, not shortly thereafter, that he also was going to attempt this, so they decided to do it as a race. So now not only are they both trying to become the first people ever to do it unsupported, but now they're racing each other. I believe at last check, Colin O'Brady was in the lead. He's a little bit younger, but this is a testament of will and smarts and making sure you can pace yourself so anything can happen. Rudd doesn't put stuff up on social media, but Colin O'Brady has a fascinating Instagram. Every day he puts up a picture from his Instagram and then sort of a description of the day. And it really is like, it's something I look forward to.
How does he recharge his phone?
So they have battery packs and satellite things. They have, I also wonder, you have a satellite signal? Like, sometimes when I'm in the Pru, I can't,
Well, the New York Times says occasionally the signal's not so hot, but I agree with you.
But they find places where they can. I also want to know, he's got some really amazing pictures. I'm like, who is taking these pictures of you? Are you like setting up your camera on your pack and timing it? I mean, it's really that may be the most fascinating part of it to me, but it's what you have to do is they have to carry food, not water because they'll melt snow and they have iodine tablets, but they each have only brought one pair of socks because they want the least amount on them as possible. And so to avoid sweating, because if you sweat, you're done. You'll get hypothermia.
I didn't know that till today either.
So if you get sweat and you're wet and it's cold, even though it's summer there, and you could develop hypothermia. So they both are like skiing across Antarctica on cross-country skis, carrying a sled behind them, and they're in like, a base layer and some pants and goggles and a hat. So, and then they dry everything at night, and then they get up and they do it all again the next day. They have all of their food and rations, and each of them only have 5 extra days of rations. So on one of these Instagram posts, Colin O'Brady talked about how one day I can't even pronounce the name. There's something weird that happens in Antarctica where there's like blowing snow and wind. It's some sort of storm. And he wasn't going to go, but he thought, if I stay in my tent, I'm early on in the trip, I'll have to use one more day of food. That only leaves me 4 days left of food. So he just said, I'm just going to try to go. And I think he did end up going like 17 miles, but they're averaging 17, 18, 19, 20 miles a day.
By the way, just to give you a perspective, you mentioned the 300 pounds that they're dragging along, whatever the hell they're doing.
Gets lighter, every time you eat something.
Just as an example, hot chocolate, which is really important to at least one of these guys, he has 15 pounds of powdered hot chocolate alone.
Yeah.
For this, you are obviously a huge admirer of these guys. Is there a piece of you that realizes how incredibly sick this behavior is?
I mean, sick is a strong word. It is. Listen, there are people who crave a different kind of adventure. Like, yeah. There are people who like to ski, and then there are people who like to do, what is it called, like fly skiing or free skiing, where, you know, they get drop you off at a helicopter and you go off some side of the mountain that isn't.
Love that.
You know, I mean, that's not for me,
right?
For me, right?
Going to Everett is about as risky as
yeah.
I want.
So yeah, some people crave tree. Some people crave that, and some people just are always.
So you don't think this is like nuts?
No, not entirely. Well, I kind of wish that I had that spirit in me.
But since they do have phones and they got the satellite deal and the
charges, if
they're dying, they can call and say, "Come get
me." So that happened. Maybe. That happened to the last guy who traversed or tried, attempted. He died.
Oh, that's worse. So it worked out well.
His name is Worsley. I think is his last name. I can't remember his first name, but he got to a point where. I think he got like an infection or something, mm-hmm. and he was airlifted out, and they actually thought he was going to live, and then he died.
Okay. So he waited too long to call for help.
Yeah, because if you're this kind of person, you don't want to destroy your unsupported effort to cross Antarctica, so you put yourself...
But I think also, Jim, I think when you're an endurance extreme athlete, and again, I'm not this kind of extreme athlete. The furthest I've ever gone is a marathon. But even when I was in Chicago, and I knew at mile 12 something was wrong.
Oh, you told us this. You kept going.
I kept going anyway. Even the year that I ran Boston, and I knew I wasn't feeling well. I knew something was wrong. You try to push through because you're stubborn and you're determined and all the things that make you a good endurance athlete mm-hmm. and make you an adventurous person can also end up in this poor guy's case.
We should do a remote broadcast from Antarctica.
Oh my God! I mean, can we?
Just like one day's worth.
Okay, wouldn't you go if you had the opportunity? No. If a travel company called you today and said, "Jim and Marjorie, we're going to do a cruise from Chile to Antarctica," you wouldn't say yes.
If there was a Taj at the finish line, yeah.
Well,
I would
no
probably.
There's no Taj there. I mean, you go on a boat and you kind of rough it a little bit.
No, I don't want to rough it. I wouldn't mind being.
How
one
long
of those
could
boats
you go without showering? Do you think?
I could go till tomorrow morning, easy. Maybe till the end of the
when
day.
When I climbed Rainier, I didn't shower for 3 days. It was amazing. I loved it.
Really?
I smelled so bad, but it just
felt
great. Like gritty and
no, that's really
and amazing.
Appealing. Me too. I found
hey,
that
so
appealing.
So one last thing before you go, Trinity. The Red Sox are going to go down to the White House. I know this was a little bit controversial because the coach had been criticized.
He's Puerto Rican.
We call him the manager, Marjorie.
The manager, I'm
Thank
sorry.
You.
Had Cora, what's his first name?
He's Puerto
Alex
Rican.
Cora.
Alex Cora.
He's Puerto Rican. He
criticized the president's handling of the Puerto Rican hurricane.
Criticized him respectfully, I should say. Not wildly. Said he was disappointed by some of the comments.
He's going to take this opportunity to say a word or two about
in
the
my way,
Puerto
he says.
Rican
Yes.
And
I don't
oversight.
Know. I don't know Alex well enough to know how he'll handle this or if he'll make a point of saying something in his remarks or pulling someone aside. I think the reason he's doing it is... As the leader of, you know, and he just signed a contract extension, mm-hmm. as the leader of not just 25 men, but all of the men that are in this organization, like it or not, there are a number of guys in that clubhouse that I would, you know, that we're pretty certain are pretty big Trump supporters. And you're not just managing, even though you're Puerto Rican, you're not just managing the Latin guys or the Dominican guys or the African Americans. You're managing every single human being in that clubhouse. And I think for him, the way he's looking at it is there are guys on my team that want to go and that this is important to. So I'm going to go because I'm the manager of all these guys that won the World Series, not just for Puerto Rico, not just for me. So I have to give him credit for that. I mean, there's a part of me that wishes he wouldn't go, but I know from a perspective of being a professional and being a leader, sometimes you have to make compromises. And I hope he really does say something and make it known that, you know, the way that things were handled in Puerto Rico and the way it was talked about and the mayor there was discussed and the infrastructure and the people, that he makes it known that that's not okay.
And by the way, no Red Sox player will be forced to go.
No, we are very interested, like, will Mookie Betts go? Will Jackie Bradley Jr. go? Will David Price attend? I wonder, like, would Rick Porcello is a guy that I wonder if maybe he would choose to sit this one out.
You know, you said last thing.
Oh, Steve
I want
Curry.
One last thing.
I forgot. Yeah,
not
that's
Steve
right.
Curry. Steph Curry.
Steph Curry. Whoops.
But the reason I would do that.
Half and half. You're close.
After we're talking about all these, you're not as bad as Ted Cruz, who called it the basketball ring we discussed yesterday.
We could get you in with Tori and Arjun.
I know that. But
yeah, we could get you in with Tori and
Arjun.
Right, that's right. I saw that video. It was a riot.
By the way, people should Google. How do they find that?
So you can just go to NBCSportsBoston.com and go to our Celtics page. Two of WGBH's lovely producers
on the show,
and Tori, are we're turning them into Celtics fans. They asked me, they said, we want to learn about basketball, and I said, this would make a great show, and so we're doing a 10-part series where we teach them about basketball and we turn them into Celtics
fans.
Is really
fun to go to the garden and hear the pounding and the singing. And
They'll get to do that March 29th. They'll get to go to their first. It'll all culminate with them going to a game.
But before you leave, in the 60 seconds, since we're talking about these men who treat women like dirt
garbage
in the NFL, talk about Steph Curry, who a lot of people love. Obviously, he's the star of the world champion Golden State Warriors. And he's explain what happened.
So he has a shoe. He's sponsored by Under Armour.
Yeah.
And he has a shoe, the Steph Curry 5. And this little girl named Riley went on the website. She wanted to order them and noticed that they weren't available on the girls' page. They were only available on the boys' page. So she handwrote a letter to Steph Curry asking why. She said, I don't want anything for free. I would just like to see the shoes put back on the girls' page. So Steph Curry wrote her a letter back. Immediately, the shoes were not only just immediately available on the girls' page, he also sent her a pair of Steph Curry 5s, said he would get her the Steph Curry 6s before they were available to anyone else. And for International Women's Day, he has invited her to the Golden State Warriors game. He's going to be a part of like a greater, bigger thing.
How great is
great
that?
Thing.
It's super heartwarming and restores my faith in humanity.
Does indeed.
Trini,
we'll see you in Antarctica.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, right. Trini Kuznary joins us every week. She's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston and a Boston Public Radio contributor. Thanks a lot, Trini. Up next, we're going to talk to Corby Kummer, our food guy. We want to know, and he's going to tell us, why restaurants have gotten so loud that you have to shout at the person 2 feet away from you, and the travails of palm oil. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. A woman chef reaches for the stars and ends up with 3 Michelins, making her the first woman in the United States to receive the highest honor from the esteemed guide. Speaking of stardom, does the latest romaine E. coli outbreak mean it's the tip of the iceberg for another lettuce's popularity? Think about that for a minute. Call me in the morning. Joining us to talk about this, the new farm bill, other headlines about food culture and policy, is food writer Corby Kummer. Corby's a senior editor at The Atlantic, a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and a BPR contributor. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello there.
So it's like food day here today at Boston Public Radio. Yeah, we got Corby Kummer. This morning we have Jacques Pepin.
Jacques Pepin and his son-in-law,
who are running this big event tomorrow at BU about culinary, 30 years of helping people with their cooking there. And we're going to have Dory Greenspan is ending the show with her great new cookbook. And in the middle, we have Corby Kummer. A chef sandwich.
You are a chef sandwich today.
The white Oreo cream. I've always wanted to be white Oreo
That's
cream.
That's a beautiful way to put it. Thank you.
So tell us about the Nobel Peace Prize nominee that is a rather famed chef now and a good friend of the President of the United States.
He is such a good friend of the President of the United States that they were engaged in a lawsuit, which they settled out of court. This is the great Jose Andres in Washington, who has become more and more of an activist as he opened restaurants that are completely my go-tos and standbys in Washington, Mediterranean, Spanish, Mexican, Chinese. Peruvian.
Well, my favorite is him, too, the Z one. Wasn't that him?
Zaytinya.
Zaytinya. Isn't that him?
Yes, you're welcome for my telling you you
best
have
Brussels
to go
Brussels sprouts
That's
in America.
That's where we went, Jim. Remember that with our crew?
Yes, I do.
And fresh-baked pita bread that comes out of the bread machine every 5 minutes.
Oh, my
God. And they keep dangerously refilling it. So great restaurants like this. That is my favorite of them, Zaytinya Oyamel. But aside from creating exciting, terrific dining environments, he has become a feed the hungry, go in and get the job done in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. And feed thousands of people and mobilize troops on the ground, find where the facilities are, where it can be made, and do it. Now, it wasn't just Hurricane Maria. He's Spanish from Catalonia, but this was in Puerto Rico, so naturally he had some kind of Latino sympathy he talked about a lot. But he had done it in Haiti for years in a clean cook stove movement that he was taking all over the world, but especially mobilizing in Haiti. So he'd worked with the State Department for years. I think he's a great candidate for the Nobel Prize. I'm so unimaginative, it would not have occurred to me, but I'm so glad that he's been nominated. And he's saying modestly, they nominate everybody.
Well, also, I would assume, and I mean this sincerely, he's got a leg up because I'm sure the Nobel Committee would love to do a slap in the face to Donald Trump. And for those who don't know, the first time we ever talked with you about Jose Andres is after Marjorie and I got back from our inaugural week in Washington. We went into the Trump Hotel where there was supposed to be a Jose Andres restaurant, but there ended up not being because Andres was upset about the disparaging remarks that candidate Trump made about Mexicans.
Yeah, rapists,
tried to pull out
murderers.
Exactly.
Drug addicts.
And then ultimately that thing was settled. But this guy not only does wonderful work, he's obviously a person of principle big time.
Yeah, he took a stand, and this is a beautiful property in Washington, an 1880s Romanesque revival, the old post office
building. It is gorgeous.
Beloved, beautifully restored. And what a shame that it's now. When I did a piece about the Trump winery, the only place you can buy it is in that old post office building in Washington, the Trump International Hotel. And I said in Vanity Fair it had the grim bonhomie of Maxim's in occupied Paris. So you go into like enemy territory. But Andres decided to pull out. And this was, you know, before Trump was even nominated.
So this next story about restaurants, how restaurants got so loud, it's like a hallelujah for me because it seems as though every place I go, especially if you're spending, you know, a good amount of money and you feel like you have to shout at people, where you're so close to someone at the next table that you can't have any kind of private discussion anymore.
Well, now that you say this, I will admit that your wonderful guest, Dori Greenspan, with whom I'll be doing a talk tonight. I'm doing a thing with her at Harvard Bookstore.
I know it's Harvard Bookstore. I don't know. You were in the interview.
Cookbook great. Is fantastic.
I am, and I'm looking for a restaurant to take her to, and I have several I want to go to in Cambridge, but all I'm thinking about is what's the noise level. And what I don't remember if the Boston Globe does ratings. So here's a piece.
Of sound, you mean?
Yeah.
In their reviews? I don't know if they do.
Well, the Washington Post does.
Does
because
it? Do
Tom
really?
Sitsima carries around a decibel measurer, and so he takes readings whenever he's
wow.
whenever he reviews.
That is a great idea.
And he
idea.
Says it, and I think that the Times critics also have a decibel meter, but I know that Tom does it. His counterparts at the San Francisco Chronicle do it. But here's a piece by Kate Wagner, whom I don't know. I emailed the terrific tech editor of The Atlantic. It ran in the tech section of The Atlantic about why did restaurants get so loud? What happened to the design?
What's the answer?
To make them so loud? Hard mid-century modern surfaces are now in fashion. But even in the mid-century, when there were beautiful expanses of steel and wood, there were also white tablecloths and carpets and curtains,
which
there are
the sound.
Not now.
But that's a conscious decision. Because let me tell you where I think this started. And it's not mentioned in this piece, but I think I actually have a little bit of a sense. As you're correcting me if I'm wrong. 20 plus years ago in New York City, when I would visit, I used to live there, but that was a lot longer ago, I would found that the exact same restaurants that I used to go to became a lot louder, mm-hmm. and it was conscious, because I remember having a discussion with one of the managers or wait people or whatever it is. And what they did, which is, what, by the way, what the old East Coast Grill did, very near where I live, which is no longer, is the ceilings were made of a certain something that off which sound bounced. The point being that while you are put off by loud sound, a lot of restaurateurs decided that people were going to be engaged by magnification of sound. So it wasn't just that they changed the physical design of the restaurant. It was a conscious decision on the part of some restaurant owners who believed that more sound meant more life and would be more appealing to the customer. Am I not right about that?
And it is.
It is?
Oh, yeah. It's more appealing. I feel that I witnessed this seismic shift myself when the old Michaela's in Cambridge, Michaela Larson, had to get a sound guy in to think about hiding cottage cheese acoustic panels in the ceiling, which were already considered ugly and very out of it in the 80s, and pads under the tables. Put your hands under the table sometimes and you'll find pads, because everyone was complaining about it. The chef she discovered, Todd English, went to Open Olives in Charlestown, and it had a fabulous eat at the bar and have the roast rotisserie chicken you would see behind the bar. Then an innovation to eat at the bar. And I went to his terrific restaurateur wife, Olivia, and I said, it's just so loud. Can you do something about this? And she said, I just crank it up. We need to do three turns tonight.
So where are you going to go in Cambridge? Where are you taking Greenspan?
I'm open to suggestion.
Really? By the way, do you know that Marjorie and I made, now we're not foodies like you are, nor are we famous in the food community. Marjorie and I made history as relates to Todd English.
Oh, gosh.
Do you know what this was?
We can
say this. It's not going to hurt his business.
You reported a fire.
We knew a person who worked in city inspectional services.
Mm-hmm.
So when his, I think, was it Olives in Charlestown?
It's Olives.
It was closed down because of rats.
Rats.
We were tipped off that it was about to be reopened on a particular night. And we and some colleagues were the first people, in fact, the only people in the restaurant, because nobody else knew about it, a bunch of us, on the night at the post-rat reopening of Olives in Charlestown, which is now legal, right?
It's
now legal,
closed,
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
Is Figs on Charles Street his only restaurant that's still here?
Figs is still here, and I don't know if it's the only one. No, I think that there's still a rustic kitchen maybe in... there's also Bonfire at the Park Plaza Hotel.
Oh, there is Bonfire.
So there's plenty of Todd English presence, and his son is Oliver becoming a great food activist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What does he do?
He's terrific. He makes documentaries about sustainability,
and
he's very
that.
Compelling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's great. Now, restaurants, how they got loud.
Yeah.
It is a conscious business decision to make restaurants loud so that people will order more alcohol and more food, which they do if it's loud.
Is that really true?
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
And to the delight of owners, they will leave sooner. But the issue that this, because when they leave sooner, it means more room
for
more
obviously,
and more money. But the very good writer, Kate Wagner, who traces a lot of technological history in this piece, doesn't quite say is this should become the secondhand smoke issue for servers. It's damaging for back-to-back shifts, for servers to have to listen to this noise every night. And I hope that they start mobilizing against noise.
Hold on for 1 second. But do customers like it? I mean, I hate it. I can't be the only one that hates it.
It's hard to find customers who actually like it, but what restaurateurs will always tell you is younger people think this is a happening and successful place if it's loud,
if you go,
and a dead old person's place if it's quiet.
Okay, you go to South Boston where everybody is now 22, and I mean, I want to shoot myself halfway through the meal. Everybody's yelling across the table. It's just crazy. But there should be maybe restaurants for 42-year-olds or 52-year-olds.
You know, 42-year-olds at the most. That's the most.
By the way, if the Globe reviews don't include what you just said, the Washington Post and others do, that is a wonderful and important idea for those who do care. Some may want it louder. Some may want it less loud. But that's a brilliant idea.
You know, the way some Southwestern restaurant reviews have a number of chilies and they're either filled in or not, definitely there are decibel levels for this.
Okay, so Corby Kummer, I don't care at all. I'm very happy for her. I don't care if, San Francisco has more three-star Michelin restaurants than any city in America. Does anybody? I know it was a big deal. I know it matters to the chef and to the owner. Does the customer, does the consumer care anymore that somebody has three stars as opposed to two, as opposed to none? And by the way, we even mentioned this, as I said at the beginning, there's a woman chef out there who became the first in America, right, to get three Michelin stars, to which I say, who cares?
Michelin. Yeah, the tire
and
man,
I said Michelin,
fat
I feel
guy.
Really bad about
no,
it.
No, you're right. It's any way you want to say it,
okay.
Because the point is we're extending their brand reach into America by arguing over how to pronounce
it. We are. It's a very fine point.
We're only giving them free publicity. They want more of it. They want people to care about their ratings.
Does anybody care? When people are selecting restaurants, I would assume Yelp and TripAdvisor and newspaper reviews matter a hell of a lot more.
You just had a terrible experience with TripAdvisor.
I did have a terrible experience, actually, in your second hometown of Hyannis. Yeah.
But how kind of you to include restaurant reviews or magazine reviews, because when I ask...
I actually often Google to see if you've written about a restaurant before I go to it, by the way.
Thank you very much, Jim. But when I recently said to a restaurateur whose restaurant closed, but we gave it such good reviews, it was so well-reviewed, are you saying that our reviews don't really matter to business? And he paused for a moment and he said, do I have to be the person who tells you? It's all TripAdvisor, which you used, and Yelp. This is what matters. As for Michelin and its famous three stars, I think it carries sway for people who think I need to spend a lot of money on an impressive occasion, and I assume that I'm going to get a certain level of service. I think, and most people who you care about food in this country or in Italy think they know nothing about Italian food, they know nothing about American food. They have very idiosyncratic standards that tend toward pomposity, very stilted originality and modernism. That's what they reward.
But can you be a non-pompous... That's what I was trying to say, and you said it before me, I think. Can you be a non-pompous restaurant and get three stars?
I think it's tough, because to get three stars, you have to have a certain level of service and formality, which are baked into their ratings.
But is everybody screaming at the three-star restaurant, too, or can you go in there and hear yourself think?
No, they're not. I can't imagine a loud restaurant getting
three
stars.
That would be a reason to go, so you wouldn't have to hear the
shout. Also, I didn't know why you so. I didn't know you were such a big... I like to be able to talk to people when I go to a restaurant,
too. Because I like to have to shout at people that are... 2 feet away from me to have them hear me, and I don't like to be so close to people, which is everywhere now. You're like 6 inches. I mean, I'm not a big person. I would think to yourself, if you are a big person, you're trying to get out between those two tables, it's very embarrassing.
With the lack of community and connection in this country, you were saying you don't wish to be close to people, Marjorie?
I do not wish to be 6 inches.
Let me tell you something.
You
I'm
are
so
a big
glad
person.
It's not just about
it's
being
terrible.
A big person. Smaller people don't like being on top of other people, too.
But trying to get out from
here's
the tables.
Here's my suggestion. What? Not only should restaurant reviews have a sound, whatever it is, they should also have a space kind of thing. Can I say where you went the day after Thanksgiving? You don't want me to say?
Sarma. Yes.
Sarma is one of Anna Sortuna. She's a partner there. She owns Oleana, all this kind of stuff. One of the beauties of Sarma, and I think one of the reasons it's impossible to get into, is not just because the food is otherworldly great, but because you are not sitting on top of people. Is that not true?
Yep.
Isn't that a big deal?
I'll say where I did go, and I was right on top of people with Tony Kuznarek. I went to Carmelina's in the North End. The food was very good. I will never go there again because I couldn't get out of the seat.
And I have another nice thing to say about a local woman-owned restaurant.
Which one?
A woman and man-owned restaurant. It is Myers and Chang. So I've always loved Myers and Chang. Which is homestyle Chinese food, original, terrific,
fabulous.
Upbeat. But it was always a place I hesitated to go because of the noise. And then I went last week, and I took some out-of-towners, and I was surprised at how decent the noise level was. It seemed to have changed, and they seemed to have taken these mitigation steps that very few restaurant owners do.
And let me just say about the two of them, one of the nicest people ever, Joanne Chang, and her husband.
Chris Myers.
Yeah, they're great.
That was a joke, by the way, for those who weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
He's actually a sweetheart, too, but a different kind of
flower bakery
character.
As well.
It's spectacular.
So let's talk about palm oil, which I have been seeing so much about lately, and terrible what's happening with palm oil.
So this is this unintended consequence. When George W. Bush said, I'm going to announce a big push for biofuels because we can no longer be petrochemical dependent and have to worry about our relations with Gulf states, we're going to be energy independent, we're going to offer a subsidy for corn growers, and we're going to put it into ethanol and biofuel. And corn farmers loved this. This seemed to be ecologically friendly, and it was just going to help everybody. And it turned out to be a complete disaster because of, first of all, the raised prices for corn, the scarcity of corn for food industry that wanted it, the higher prices for oil, and then mostly it was the plundering of forests and deforestation and oxygen in the countries like Indonesia that weren't growing palm particularly but had the capacity to in the climate and started growing all these palms to compensate for the lack of petrochemicals and new energy independence. And when you read what this market did, it's slave labor, it's incredible lack and depredation of land in Indonesia, and a community by community, it has destroyed entire areas of Indonesia.
How come this has been so far, at least below the radar for me, and maybe I'm just uninformed, but one of the statistics in this piece that we read this morning was, what are they saying, the equivalent of 300 football fields is clear-cut every single day in the world to produce palm oil? That is surreal.
It is surreal, but what the piece in the New York Times did, it was also beautifully illustrated, it's one of their multimedia specials, was directly connect one policy decision, a speech made in the United States, to incredible deforestation on the other side of the world. And it quotes environmentalists as saying, this is going to be trouble. It looks good, but it's going to be trouble. And indeed, it turned out that way. And so a piece like this, which was paid for by ProPublica, a great nonprofit.
They've done fabulous things these days.
So it's really their credit that did that. Is, for example, if you try to get a smoking gun for obesity, it's not quite accurate to say that the low-fat movement led to high sugar, but there's some truth in it. It's trying to connect these dots. So what this palm oil piece did was say, not only are forests being clear cut, that's bad, it doesn't go into the Amazon, we know how terrible it is in the Amazon, but it says, here's where the market's changed because of George Bush's speech. And so it draws this direct line to this environmental devastation.
What's palm oil in?
Everything.
Yeah, palm oil is in lots of food.
So we should look for the ingredients and make sure we're not buying something.
Well, not just food.
Yeah, no, it's an industrial use. And the EPA is just not taking steps to try to change this.
Well, the EPA, as we know, is run now by a coal lobbyist. So
right.
I don't think we're going to get much help from the EPA in this administration.
Before we leave, can we end on an up note? Because this has been like too depressing.
Okay.
We've discussed the Farm Bill a lot with you here. We've discussed food stamp benefits. They're called SNAP benefits a lot. There actually was a positive outcome out of the United States Congress, which sounds like the ultimate oxymoron. But actually, it was a really good outcome, at least on the food stamp front, was it not?
A great outcome. So why did it happen? It's the deterrent effect of the midterm elections.
So
it's saying the House has changed. The House had passed this punitive version of the Farm Bill that imposed work requirements on people getting food stamps, which was going to have an enormous deterrent effect on especially young parents, because they're directly in the group that's supposed to prove you spent 20 hours a week looking for work. How do you prove that? How do you document it? And what the Trump administration cynically knew was, just by imposing this red tape, they would really reduce the rolls, which they consider to be welfare. The Senate said, no, we're not going to do that. The Senate has always been protective of food stamps.
And the Republican-led Senate, since we criticize the Republicans a lot, we should say.
And also the Trump administration within the previous or the current House, but in the lame duck, also tried to get rid of a lot of environmental protections, because it's hard to remember that the Farm Bill is also one of the chief environmental protection bills passed by the U.S. government. And they were trying to, there's something called the Conservation Stewardship Program, cover crops, graze pasture, work to minimize pesticide applications. All these things are great. And the House version said, no more money for it. Forget that stuff. We're going to protect industrial agriculture. That's back. And so the deal in principle, not signed yet, but announced last week, is saying no work requirements for food stamps, and we're going to keep these conservation measures.
For 5 years, am I not right?
Yeah, it's in force for 5 years.
By the way, before you go, we only have 30 seconds left. When you ask what's palm oil in, let me just read a line from this piece here. It can be found in 40% of everyday products on supermarket shelves, from donuts to shampoo, chips to ice cream, even appears in the gas tank of your car. So the answer is do a little research. Good to see you, Corby Kummer.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much, Corby Kummer. Award-winning food writer Corby Kummer joins us every week. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy. Thanks, Corby. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest headlines flying out of Washington, D.C. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining the line to go over the latest politics headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, of course, is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon, Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. Hello there, John King.
Hello. Happy Tuesday.
And
happy
to you.
Great to talk to you. John King, first, a compliment to you. Your Sunday morning show was great because the perspective you had on George H.W. Bush was very different from a lot of other people's, and I thought it was terrific. I want to know if you knew the former president, George H.W. Bush. Did you cover him?
Not very well. I didn't know him well. I met him on several occasions, but I covered the Dukakis campaign. Was my first campaign in 1988.
Yep.
And I spent a couple days. The AP let me go over and spent a couple days with him. I will say this. His staff always treated me very well. I was 24 years old. I was in way over my head. I had no idea what I was doing, and I was covering a national campaign for president. And the Bush staff always treated me very well in the sense that, you know, when you called from the Dukakis plane to try to get reaction, you know, they could have said, as a 24-year-old kid, to heck with him. You know, we'll call the New York Times. But they treated me fairly, and I loved that. When I saw him very quickly in that campaign, he came over to me once and said hello and said, you know, why are you covering the other guy? It was just a quick joke. And I spent a little bit of time with him in the 92 campaign as well. Got to know him a bit during a minimum wage debate. Ted Kennedy, I was covering labor issues when I first came to Washington for the AP. I came right as Reagan was leaving and Bush came into office. And Ted Kennedy passed a minimum wage increase, and Bush vetoed the first version of it, and they had to negotiate a compromise. And so just a little bit. I knew his son, George W., much better. I covered the White House in those days. But my interactions with the former president were mostly brief. Always, he's just an incredibly whatever you think of the Bush family's politics, they're incredibly gracious, well-mannered people. And the last time I saw him was during the debates in 2016, right after Jeb Bush had dropped out, and you know, and he said hello, and Barbara Bush joked, and we've lost her as well. Barbara Bush joked that, quote unquote, you could have treated Jeb a little nicer. I think she was joking, it was a fun conversation.
John, are you surprised that in his instructions for his funeral, the late president decided that Donald Trump, who has essentially disparaged everyone in his family, including President Bush himself, is invited to attend, though not speak?
I'm not surprised because of the president's respect for the institution, the president's respect for tradition. The current president is always there to say farewell to a former president. The fact that President Trump is not speaking is news in its own right. The current president always speaks. This will be the first time, at least in any modern presidential historian can track, where the current president didn't at least have brief remarks. I also am surprised, and I want to give him credit, that the President Trump has actually handled this pitch perfect so far. Went up to the Rotunda last night, sent his plane, is going over to see the Bush family in private today. Look, there's a ton of bad blood here. He has trashed 41. He has trashed 43. It was low-energy Jeb in the primaries. The Bush family has given back, too. They've, you know, I mean, fired back at times during this. But this is bigger than that, and I think everybody realizes that. Even President Trump realizes this is bigger than that. And so I give everybody credit, in starting with the Bush family, which reached out over the summer and said, look, it is the former president's wish. He's in bad health. It is his wish that the president be there, and we want to make this work. And so the Bush family started it, and Melania Trump today has Laura Bush coming over. The president himself is with Melania, is walking over to Blair House. This is the way it should work. No matter who our president is, this is the way it should work, and I think we should all say amen and be grateful that at least so far it's working the way it should.
One last question about the late president. Obviously, this has more residents here than anywhere in the country, even though I'm sure everybody who lived through 1988, like you covering it, remembered it. We've talked a lot about the Willie Horton ad in the last couple of days, and we all know the rather venal soul who put it together, Lee Atwater. Even he himself, on his deathbed, and he died, I think it was at 40, very young, apologized for the ad. Why do you think that President Bush himself never took the same step?
It's a great question. But look, I think we need to be honest when we have these conversations, that as we pay tribute to a man who was a war hero, was full of grace, had the most impressive resume of anybody ever to be president of the United States, was a kinder, gentler soul. Guess what? He was also an incredibly fiercely competitive soul, who had a mean political streak in him when necessary. The thing he did was that Bush often delegated that to other people. So you had this aw shucks, soft-spoken sort of Yankee patrician guy, kinder, gentler, but he had his son, George W., was an enforcer in those campaigns. It was Roger Ailes, was a Republican ad man in those days, who made that ad before he came to Fox News, Lee Atwater. There was racially tinged items in some of the Bush campaigns. They did not run a kind, gentle campaign against Bill Clinton either, mind you. And so, you know, that's part of who Bush was. He was fiercely competitive. He just hit it. He hit it inside, and he often delegated it to other people. That's a fair comment. Is it criticism? Some people would say good for him. He ran a tough campaign, and he won. If you remember those days, Dukakis was up 17 points when he gave his acceptance speech in Atlanta. And he lost 40 states. I mean, it was a blowout. It was not a close election. I remember it. Boston Harbor, Willie Horton,
Tank.
There was the tank.
Yeah.
That was my introduction to national politics. And there are a lot of things you forget as you get older. Those couple of years I remember like yesterday.
We're talking to John King from CNN.
So, John King, the Mueller-Russia investigation seems to be accelerating. We're expecting some sentencing memos on Michael Flynn, formerly very close to the president.
Right, that should come today. And look, Bob Mueller does not talk in public. He talks in court filings. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the Michael Cohen filing last week, we learned a lot, that Michael Cohen now says Russia business dealings went on well deep into the campaign, into June, when the president was saying lower sanctions, when the president was saying, or the president's campaign team watered down the Republican platform. And the president says Michael Cohen's lying, but Robert Mueller knows the president's going to say that. And there are emails and other documents included in the court filing that back Cohen up. So now we haven't heard from Michael Flynn in a year. Nothing. He pleaded guilty a year ago, but what's he been telling? What's he cooperating? Does he have anything of value? We don't know that he does, but we do know that Mueller has to file a sentencing memo, and it is in these documents where he has told us how this witness fits into the narrative, what they told us, how we corroborated it, where the investigation's going. So I think by the time we go to bed tonight, we're going to have more information about the path of Mueller, which from all accounts, whether it's the Cohen filings, the attempt to try to get a plea deal with Roger Stone's friend Jerome Corsi about possible collusion, to the defense lawyers here in town who were in communication back and forth with Mueller's office, everyone thinks think of this as a pyramid. Everybody thinks we're getting to the point where, you know, it's a lot more narrow. We're getting to the top. And at the top, the focus, I'm not saying they have any evidence of anything, but if you look at the Cohen documents, if you talk to the people around town, look at the attempted plea with Corsi, the president is a central figure in what Bob Mueller is trying to get at right now. So that's why the president's so angry.
Can we attempt to get an answer from you that we attempted to get the other day from someone who is friendly with George Conway because she clerked for the same federal judge that he did? That's Jennifer Braceras, who's a regular guest on our show. What is up with Kellyanne Conway and George Conway? The latest from George Conway, we know that, and she's a chief advisor and defender of the president. I think a pretty effective one as defenders go. The latest from her husband is that when Donald Trump tweeted, I guess it was yesterday, his give Michael Cohen a full sentence and Roger Stone's got real guts, that he was engaging in witness tampering. And I don't want to debate the law, but what is up with that? Do you have any insight into what's going on there with the Conways?
There are 100 theories in Washington. Some of them, they include this, that Kellyanne knows when she eventually leaves the Trump White House, whenever that is, that she's going to have a lot of repair work to do with the Republican establishment, and this is somehow a way for George Conway to help her by saying, you know, she's known all along that this place is a mess. I don't know the answer. Kellyanne has pushed back on numerous occasions saying, you know, he's my husband, he's an accomplished attorney, he has the right to his opinion. You know, you wouldn't be doing this if it was the other way around and I was a woman and he was inside the White House. I'm not sure that's true, but her point is there's some sexism here because we can't accept her as an accomplished woman and just let her do her job. My own personal take here is that, you know, someday on Bravo, a year or two from now, we're going to be keeping up with the Conways. I just don't know what else to make. I don't know what else to make of it. And I mean no disrespect to either of them, but it's just the age we live in that it makes absolutely no sense. Therefore, it fits perfectly in the Trump age.
Last thing, John, on Mueller is Isikoff, I guess, who wrote this morning, was on your air earlier today. He is not alone, but he is amongst the leaders who says all the evidence, circumstantial evidence, suggests that we're about to reach the close of the Mueller investigation. Do you buy that?
I do, and Michael's a damn good reporter when it comes to cops and robbers. He's got a career of, you know, being very smart about this stuff, and he knows the key players involved, and so I think he should take his reporting very seriously. I don't think anybody knows for sure, in the sense that are there going to be more indictments? Some of these cases that are already in the pipeline are going to carry over into next year and could go on longer if there are appeals and, you know, things like that. So I think some of the ramifications of the Mueller probe are going to go on well into 2019. However, to answering the key questions about collusion and obstruction of justice and writing some form of a report and then putting more of these key pieces of information, again, Mueller's protecting himself. He understands, and I don't, that sounds nefarious, but he understands the political environment he's working in. He understands now that come January, the Democrats will control the House, which is, I assume, from a transparency standpoint, of some comfort to him if you want to make sure there are people to follow up on your work. But so we're going to get a report at some point, but we're also getting the report. I mean, if you take what's been filed so far in the Manafort and what's been filed in the Gates and what was filed, you know, every time they try to put somebody in jail or defend the integrity, remember, every time Mueller's appointment has been challenged, his scope has been challenged, his legitimacy has been challenged by judges appointed by Democrats and Republicans, he has won. And in every court filing, he gives us more nuggets. So in this Flynn filing today, a Manafort filing that's due Friday, a couple more coming around the corner in the future, we're going to get pieces of chapters, if you will, of the Mueller report in those filings. Will he put it all together by the end of the year? Will that go till January or February? I don't think anyone knows a firm answer there, but you do get a sense from the defense lawyers as Mueller's team comes back and asks follow-up questions that they're tying things up, that they're not spreading into broad new avenues. They're trying to tie up loose ends. Now, it depends on the cooperation of the witnesses, how fast they can do that. But I do think, I don't think we'll be talking about this by Easter the way we talk about it now. It'll be much more in the rearview mirror, I think, when we get, you know, through the new year and probably a month or two into the new year. I will add this one caveat, is that remember, he has also handed things off to the Southern District of New York. There are New York State investigations into the Trump Foundation and Trump charities. So even if Bob Mueller announced in the middle of this conversation we're having right now, I'm done, here's my report, that doesn't end things. And plus, the last part of that, forgive me, is the Democrats are going to take back the House. So the investigations are not over by any means. But I do think Mueller is, I think we're in the 2 to 3 month phase there and maybe on the short end of that.
We're talking to John King from CNN.
So John King, Gina Haspel, the head of the CIA, apparently who has heard this tape of the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, she briefed senators today and Corker from Tennessee and Lindsey Graham from, where's Lindsey Graham from?
South Carolina.
South Carolina had extremely harsh words for the Crown Prince. I think Lindsey Graham, I think I saw on your station, said they didn't find a smoking gun, they found a smoking saw. And Corker said if it were a jury trial, he would have found him guilty in about 30 seconds of murder. What do we make of this?
We make that the administration is going to face a heap of criticism from Congress and probably more sanctions from Congress to impose on Saudi Arabia, including cutting off arms sales, unless the administration has a change of heart and says we're going to take the lead here. You're right. Lindsey Graham came out and says there's no smoking gun. There's a smoking saw. Democrats who've come out are essentially leaving this to the Republicans, knowing that it's more damning to hear the Republicans say these things about the administration than it is the Democrats, but coming out saying, you know, Democrats like Dick Durbin saying, I went in convinced Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, orchestrated this, and I come out more convinced based on what I've heard. You just mentioned Bob Corker saying a jury would convict him in 30 minutes. There's no doubt here. And yet, the president, his secretary of state, and others keep saying, you know, we need to give him a pass. They don't need to give him a pass. The president's right when he says, you can't just walk away from Saudi Arabia. They're too important in that part of the world. They're too important when it comes to Iran. They're too important when it comes to the Persian Gulf shipping. They're too important when it comes to the world oil markets and, because of that, world financial markets. But there's a way to sanction somebody, punish somebody, put somebody in the doghouse, and say, we want to maintain. We did this with the Soviets. We do this with the Russians today. We're in the middle of this with the Chinese on trade. And suddenly we treat Saudi Arabia like, well, they just killed some guy and cut him into little pieces. But, you know, we need to give him a pass. So there's a fundamental disconnect here between how things normally work and how the Trump presidency is trying to deal with this. But make no mistake, this is not the Democrats in the House. Wait till the Democrats get in the House. They'll be more aggressive, too. These are Republicans in the president's own party saying, this makes no sense. America must not behave this way. And if you don't change your behavior, Mr. President, we're going to change it for you.
Hey, John, last thing from me. Speaking of Democrats taking control of the House, Seth Moulton, Congressman Moulton, was with us on Friday and we talked to him about his quest against Nancy Pelosi. 30-some people, I guess, in the caucus last week did not vote for her. Roughly half as many as voted against her when Congressman Ryan was running against her the last time Democrats were in charge. What's your Nostradamus-like sense of what happens on January 3rd? I think it's January 3rd when the vote for the next speaker occurs.
All indications are that she is making slow, steady, methodical progress. She's not there yet, but she's winning over some of the new members. She's winning over some of her critics. She's even Steve Lynch from Massachusetts.
Yep.
Says he's open to, you know, so she has been methodically going through the problems, meeting with the people she can turn, and going there. Is she there completely yet? No. But I think, you know, the odds have increased since we spoke a week ago that Nancy Pelosi will be the next Speaker of the House. I would say that the quicksand for her, if there is quicksand, is how she handles these government shutdown negotiations with the president. They were supposed to be this week. They're going to do a timeout temporary bill because of the President Bush farewell. But she's going to sit down with Chuck Schumer and the president. They're going to sit down, the three of them, next week, and they have to figure out the border wall. And so how can she be bipartisan but also be tough in negotiations with the president? The new members don't get to vote on this budget deal, but they'll be watching. And so she's got to be careful here that this is the test, right? She says she's the grown-up who can go into these negotiations and cut fair deals, but get the Democrats more than they've been getting the last few years. Well, there's the test next week. But again, you know, you applaud Congressman Moulton in the sense that by being so public about this, he risks the ramifications of it if she wins. At the moment, she's winning, and I think she's winning by more today than she was when we talked last Tuesday.
John, it's great to talk to you as always. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, John. John King joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. And he did have an extraordinary show this Sunday morning. Anyway, up next, continuing our cookathon today, Jim.
Food-a-thon. Big food day, it is.
The award-winning cookbook writer Dori Greenspan is here to talk about her latest book, Every Day. Dori, you're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If the saying is true that you are what you eat, then I want to eat like Dori Greenspan, because for starters, she calls New York City, Westbrook, Connecticut, and Paris home, and no better way to eat like her than by way of her latest cookbook, Everyday Dori, The Way I Cook. I'm checking it out tonight. Dori Greenspan, of course, is the On Dessert columnist for the New York Times Magazine. You can catch her tonight at 7 o'clock at the Great Harvard Bookstore in conversation, speaking of great, with our buddy Corby Kummer. Dori, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much
for
being here.
So good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with your fantastic new cookbook, Everyday Dori. Tell us what's distinctive about this.
So this is my 13th book, A Baker's Dozen.
Thank you.
Right? Of cookbooks. And I think this is my simplest, most practical cookbook. I call this my Stop and Shop Big Y cookbook. Because, well, I did most of these recipes while I was living in rural Connecticut, you know, 1 hour round trip from a supermarket.
Oh.
And so these are recipes using really basic ingredients where I've just tried to like pull every little bit of flavor that I could out of the ingredients. And I was cooking from my fridge. I was shopping and cooking from my refrigerator door and my pantry.
Well,
let
you
me
know,
tell you
okay.
what, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, Jim is a better cook than I am. I am not a very good cook, and I find it very intimidating. But also, because I'm not a very good cook, it takes me forever. Like, if it would take somebody that's good a half hour, it would take me 3 hours because I'm just not very good. But you know what you do, and I said this to you before when I'm on the air, that is so brilliant. You talk about how to store the food, what will last a long
working
time.
Ahead.
Working ahead. Working
right.
ahead.
So tell us about that, because I think that is just fantastic.
Well, you know, the reading line in the book is how I cook. And I cook, I think the way most people do, in the amount of time that I have. I'm always grabbing an extra minute. And so while I'm working on a recipe and developing it for publication, I'm thinking, oh, that could be put away. This could be made ahead. You could freeze this whole thing. Because I want to make it easy for myself, and I want to make it easy for you. You know, when you write a cookbook, you really only want, or at least I only want, two things. I want to get everybody into the kitchen. I feel like I'm an evangelist for you know, for home cooking and home baking. And I want you to be successful. I want you to enjoy making it and be happy sharing it with people. So I really work to make the recipes as practical and as doable as possible.
But you know what you need to help me with? I'm not a better cook than Marjorie. I'm willing to try more than Marjorie is. But you know what I'm really intimidated by? You say in your introduction throughout the thing, you have a section called choices. You mean options, things you can mm-hmm. do. But you also suggest that cooks be adventurous a little bit, meaning go outside your comfort zone. Those aren't your words. They're my interpretation right. of your words. I'm too nervous to go outside my comfort zone. How do I cure myself of
that? Well, you don't have to be cured.
Okay.
You don't have to be cured. So what I do in my cookbooks is I make a recipe that I work on and test and have retested, and so that recipe will work. It'll work just as it's written. And then I give you, the choices or the playing around. And that, I hope, will encourage you to maybe not be adventurous, but if you don't have an ingredient, to make a swap. If you think you'd like it just a little differently, here's how you can do it. So the full bulletproof recipe is there, and then that's there to just kind of help you a little bit if you want to.
I do want to. Can we talk, since it is all about me, let's talk about my two favorite foods
okay.
are in your cookbook.
Oh.
Brussels sprouts.
Yes.
And when I was a law student in New York City, I had no money. I would save up once a week. I would save $8, and I would go to Shakespeare's on A Street in the Village mm-hmm. and have shepherd's pie. And so I've been making it forever, but I have to admit, it's fairly dull. So can we start with that for a second?
Might like my shepherd's pie.
Well, tell us.
Well,
I'm trying it tonight,
it
actually.
This morning.
So it's, I call it the Mediterranean shepherd's pie mm-hmm. because the flavorings are not classic. I also have butternut squash in it. I have either kale or spinach. There's thyme, or if you have za'atar, you can use it. There's sumac, or if you don't have sumac,
Ooh,
you
I
can
have
use
sumac.
You have it.
Ooh.
Now's the time to get it out. But you could use lemon zest. So it's this mix of flavors that are unexpected. I love when a recipe has a surprise. When you say, I've been making shepherd's pie, or I've been eating it all my life, I love to give you a shepherd's pie that you taste and say, oh, this is completely different.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Oh, I think.
Am I going to say that at the end of this thing?
I think.
How
you
convinced
will.
Are you? You are convinced.
I'm convinced.
I'm psyched.
I'm convinced.
I am really psyched.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's
call me in the morning.
Let's hear about the Brussels sprouts.
Oh, so the Brussels sprouts are cooked with maple syrup and mustard.
Oh, my
How
gosh.
Great does this
right?
sound?
And bacon. So, I mean, all the things that we love. And so I cook them very quickly. I boil them, dry them, and then just, you know, heat them up in a pan so that they hold their shape, they're still green, and they have those wonderful flavorings around them.
I'm going to text Corby when you're with him tonight and give you the results, and you can we'll find out how this
cool.
worked out. We're talking to Dory Greenspan. Her latest is Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook. You know, every interview I've ever read with you, ever includes, even if you don't say it, every interviewer says, oh, she burned down her kitchen when she was 12 years old. Now, here's what I worry about. I worry about that it's not true. But you can't say anymore that it's not true because it's been repeated 10,000 times. So raise your right hand and tell me you burned down your kitchen.
I'm raising my right hand. I'm putting my hand on my cookbook.
Fine, that's good.
Right?
Okay, what happened?
It involved stupidity, a pot of oil, frozen French fries, and the lid that I put on top of the boiling oil.
Okay.
Right? It's true.
Did you really burn down?
No.
You created a fire.
I created a fire that went to the cabinets above the stove, right? That went to the ceiling, that went to the police, the fire department coming. My parents were out for the night, and when they came home, they found us sitting at the top of the stoop, right, going to the house, the steps, with the fire people behind us.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, now that I'm a mother, I mean, I thought it was kind of just a story then. Now that I'm a mother, I think, oh, what would I have done?
How much damage did you do to the kitchen?
The newly renovated kitchen, the one that I brought, yeah.
Oh, it was newly renovated?
Yeah, it had to be re-renovated.
Oh,
well, I'm sorry
gosh.
It happened, but I'm glad that
they
it's true.
They must have been
it's
thrilled.
True. It's
I'm
true.
Glad that it's true.
We're talking to Dory Greenspan. The new book is called Everyday Dory. But you are famous as the dessert columnist of the New York Times, too. And you've written so many other cookbooks about, and 5 James Beard Awards about desserts. What can you tell us about desserts in here?
So these desserts, you know, it's funny, when the book came out, somebody I met said, I didn't know you cooked. You know, I do.
You're a baker.
Yeah, but I do make dinner before I make dessert. So the desserts in this book are, like the recipes in this book, very simple. I've got a pie, I've got a crisp, I've got a celebration cake. I made it for Thanksgiving, and I'm going to do it for Christmas. The triple layer parsnip and cranberry cake. Mm. You know, think carrot cake, but parsnips and juicy cranberries with ginger. So I wanted the desserts to match the food. I wanted them to be simple. So things like my new chocolate chip cookies, which are chewy because I put just a little bit of oatmeal in them. Poached pears, which I think poached fruit is overlooked as a great dessert.
Poached fruit?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's soft and sweet.
It's soft, it's sweet, it's easy, it's elegant. You could serve it in a fancy, you know, at the end of a fancy-ish meal. You could serve it on a Tuesday night. I think we forget how much we can do simply.
Do you watch The Great British Baking Show?
I've watched it. I'm so afraid that all I'm going to do is watch it.
It is.
Right?
It
I'll
is,
never write another
let
book.
Let me tell you, in this turbulent world, we have a lot of people on who say literature, music, whatever is a perfect escape. There is no better escape from the turbulence of the world than The Great British Baking Show. It is unbelievable.
This is what everyone says. So I feel,
check it out more.
Well, but I create my own little, you know, American baking world. Mm. I feel like when I'm in the kitchen and I'm working with ingredients, I'm using my hands, I'm making something that I'm going to share with people. That's my little cocoon. That keeps
well,
the turbulence at bay.
You know, earlier today, we mentioned this is a big food day for us on the show. We had Corby, your buddy,
right,
with us, as he comes every week. Earlier in the show, he doesn't come with us every week. Jacques Pepin was here.
Oh.
Jacques is here because tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of the BU Culinary School, mm-hmm, that he and Julia Child put together. But I read somewhere this morning that Jacques Pepin rescued a bluefish marinade.
You,
I did, and of yours. So can you tell
that
us
a great
that story.
Story?
What happened?
So he didn't rescue it as much as make it so much better. Jacques was coming for dinner with his wife, Gloria.
Is that intimidating, by the way?
I wasn't at my most comfortable.
Okay, fine.
Yeah,
okay.
This was the first time he was coming for dinner, and I was making bluefish, and I had marinated it and then drained the marinade and put the fish on the grill. And I was about to toss out the marinade, and Jacques said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, it's done." He said, "No." He said, "It has another life." And he boiled it, and I had chopped some tomatoes, and he rolled the tomatoes in the marinade and put that over the bluefish. And it was delicious. And I have remembered that idea of taking the marinade, cooking it, and using it again. And I do that in a chicken recipe.
So he was right in the kitchen.
Right in the kitchen.
In a supervisory role when you were making the dinner.
So Jacques is a born teacher.
Yeah.
He can't, I mean, if you say, here's a bottle of water, he'll say, you know, water originally came down from, I mean, he just knows everything.
With no pretentiousness.
With no
though,
pretension.
Yeah.
And so I was in the kitchen, and it's an open, my kitchen in Connecticut, and it's open, and he just couldn't help himself. You could see his fingers were itching to do something, and he really, once again, taught me something.
You know, speaking of, the first thing I ever made, I just realized in my whole life, as I'm asking you about your bluefish marinade, first thing I ever made, other than, like, boiling an egg, was I made bluefish pate out of a cookbook. Remember Jane Alexandria, the review, who was an actress who,
mm-hmm,
became the,
yes,
head of the National,
yes,
Endowment for the,
yeah,
Arts or something?
She had a cookbook?
And she had a cookbook on bluefish
only. I did
only.
Not know that.
On,
know,
bluefish
on
only?
On bluefish only. And you know one of the recommendations, which I tried and worked, is you wrap bluefish, I don't know what you put on it, wrapped it in heavy aluminum foil, put it on the engine in your car, and why are you making a face at me?
Oh,
I'm not
you ever tried
a
it?
Face. No, I've never tried it.
So how do you know, right?
How do I know? You're right.
Exactly.
The engine,
right,
of your car.
And it was,
oh,
yeah, and it was fabulous.
Okay,
yeah.
So there was a book called Carburetor Cooking.
Is that really true?
Yes, yes.
Well, I guess that's a variation
I mean,
on
I don't
the
know
theme.
Where a carburetor is. It might be
I don't
the
know
same.
Either,
okay,
actually,
right.
But it's the same sort of thing. We're talking to Dory Greenspan, her latest cookbook, which looks fabulous. And by the way, it's Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook. Ellen Silverman, who took the photos, is
the photos are beautiful.
Otherworldly
beautiful. They're gorgeous.
Yeah.
So you live part-time. time in Paris?
I do.
Is that because of the cooking, or is it just because Paris is wonderful and romantic and all that? Why?
Because I'm a very lucky woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. Why. So I went to Paris with my husband, who, you know, I was born and then I got married. And we went...
In that order.
Exactly. And we went to Paris, and I got there, I put my feet down on Paris sidewalk, and thought, my mother made this horrible mistake. She had me in Brooklyn. And I spent the rest of my life making up for it. Yeah. So
how different? You know, I've heard stories about totally different attitudes about meals in Paris in regular families where, everybody sits down for like 2 hours at night. Is that still true? It's still true. So what's that about? Tell us.
Well, I don't know if it's still true with, you know, kids running around and, you know, but among my friends, dinner is a 2 hour at least event. So people come, we spend an hour having an aperitif, I make gougère.
What's gougère?
Gougère are cheese puffs.
Okay.
And I make them by the hundreds and put them in the freezer. And then when people come, I just pop them in the oven and have them ready to have with sparkling wine or white wine. And I've got a new recipe for that in the book. But so we'll sit around, we'll have a little cocktail, we'll drink wine, and then we'll sit at the table. And that dinner lasts. It's a starter. It's a main course. It might be a cheese course. It's dessert. But the food is not, I mean, whatever idea you have about French food, if it came from a restaurant, that's not what home cooking is. Home cooking is what I call, you know, elbows on the table food, where you're there to share a meal and to tell stories.
And if you're just someone that's starting out and has trouble, like I do, even though my kids are all grown up and gone, I won't even tell you what I used to feed them when they were little. But
they grew up.
They did. They did. It was amazing. They did. But how do you learn this? Is it just doing the same recipes over and over again so you feel comfortable? Or how do you get that vocabulary that you need to be a cook?
You know, I don't know that you need the vocabulary, and I don't know that you really need the ease. As I'm watching your hands, they kind of say, I want to be comfortable doing this. I think you make a decision about how you want to eat, how you want things to be around your table, and you cook. It doesn't have to be, you can make scrambled eggs and have that be a meal that everyone will enjoy. I think it's more how you feel about the meal, how you feel about having people around your table. And, I mean, I find I like every part of cooking. Not the shopping so much, but I like the food prep. I like touching the food. I like transforming it. And I think if you take pleasure in each step, you come to enjoy cooking and you come to enjoy sharing what you've made.
Okay, Dora, we only have a minute left. Let's return to me for a second. I told you
I was missing you.
I'm
going to
make
you.
The shepherd's pie, but I want my confidence to be built with the first thing I make from your cookbook so that I will come back for more. Putting aside the shepherd's pie for a second, unless you think that fits what I'm about to describe, what's the thing you think a cook of, I'd say, slightly below average skills, me, would do well enough that he would be encouraged to come back for more? What's the recipe that I should choose?
You ask a hard question, but so you're choosing a good recipe in shepherd's pie.
And I can do that?
Oh, I know you can do it.
And you can freeze it for a long time.
That's right.
Very important.
But also, I love making chicken, a whole chicken, in a Dutch oven. So it requires nothing but putting the chicken in the Dutch oven.
I can do that.
Putting the Dutch oven in the oven.
I can do both those things.
Right?
Yes.
So, and I like it. If you make a little seasoned butter and put it under the skin of the chicken, so it's like, I mean, that takes nothing. It's just like playing with the chicken. That's a recipe that looks beautiful when it comes out of the oven. The whole house smells good, and you've done nothing but essentially, you know, made a little home for the chicken in that
Consider it done. Dory Greenspan, thanks for the advice.
Yeah,
I'm
thank
honored.
You very
Great
much.
To
congratulations
so much.
On
to
another spectacular
cookbook
book.
Looks fabulous.
Dory Greenspan is the on-dessert columnist for the New York Times Magazine and a cookbook author. Her latest book, Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook. She's going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock in Cambridge, of course, in conversation with our friend Corby Cummer. Dori Greenspan, thank you very much
for
coming.
Thank
you. Much appreciated.
And
thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to the people that came down to the
Boston
Public Library. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, and our on-site engineer, Dave Goldstein. And special thanks to the guys and gals of the Newsfeed Cafe, What's on Television, Jim Bradley.
Well, you actually know my first two guests, Angela and Danroy Henry. You know, their son, DJ, was killed by a cop in Mount Pleasant, New York, exactly 8 years ago. Saturday night, there was a new chapter in this story. They're still looking for justice for DJ. 48 Hours did an hour-long special on it. We're going to talk about whether or not that will move this forward. And then Don Stern, former U.S. attorney, who obviously worked with Bob Mueller, and former federal judge Nancy Gertner, they're going to join me because, as John King just told us, a lot of people think it's Mueller time coming to a head. So we're going to talk about that as well. 7 o'clock.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Bradley.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.